think they can be as shitty as they want.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I would like to call this Joint Interim Task Force on Oregon Shellfish to order this Wednesday, January 20th, 2016. First of all, I want to thank staff for trekking over here with all of their equipment. They have to leave very early in the morning to do these off-site meetings, and I'm very grateful for them that they keep us well organized. We will be on the record and thank them for their early departure this morning. The first thing I'd like to do is go around the room. We've met once, but we have some participants that weren't here last time, and just do a brief round of introductions so we can get a sense for on the record for who's in the room. And Jess, let's start with you, please.
Jess Sample, operator of Coos Bay Oyster Company.
John Ivey, Coos Bay and Coquitlam Indian Tribe Tribal Council.
Frank Barsoles, the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Food Safety Program, one of the Food Safety Program managers.
Alex Manderson, Oregon Department of Agriculture and Shellfish Program.
Benoit Hansen, Pacific Seafood, Tillamook.
Nathan Hansen, Pacific Seafood, I'm on a farm soup.
I'm Andrew Chaffin with the Nature Conservancy, I'm a program manager for the Coast and Marine Program.
Steve Rumrell with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, I'm in the Shellfish Program for the state.
And I'm Kathy McHugh, and I represent House District 9 from Coos Bay to Yahats.
I'm Dan Roper. I'm committee staff.
Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, which is Northwest Oregon.
Gil Sylvia from Oregon State University, director of the Coastal Oregon Marine Experiment Station.
Mike Sandin, general manager, Puerto Garibaldi.
I thank you all for traveling here, for those of you who had to get up and drive. I think it might also be helpful just to go around the room. We have a number of guests in the room, and I'll start with the governor's staff.
Gabriella Goldfarb, Natural Resources Policy Advisor to Governor Kate Brown.
Christina Lee, Sea Grant Fellow, formerly with the Coastal Caucus, now with the Governor's Natural Resources Policy Office.
You, sir?
The governor's office, but...
but you're very welcome.
I'm Chris Langdon. I'm a professor at the COOMS, the Coastal Oregon Marine Experiment Station here at Hatton.
I'm delighted to have you here. Thank you.
Hi, Beth Riley, committee staff also. Maybe we're on committee staff. Samantha Kootman, committee staff.
Important people.
I'm Bill Hampshiremaker. I'm here at Hatfield Marine Science Center. I'm with Oregon Sea Grant.
Chuck Pavlik, ALSI Port Commissioner.
Welcome. Roxy Cleland, Port of ALSI Manager.
I'm Joe Rowley, I'm the commissioner on Port of ALSI also.
I'm Rita Jimenez, I'm a PhD candidate at the University on behalf of Dr. George Bobaha.
I'm Brett Dumbald, I work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the Agriculture Research Service.
Thank you for your interest in this process, all of you who are coming to observe. I'd like to take a moment and discuss the task force objectives for a few minutes. You have, I believe, at your places, a document that at the top says Joint Interim Task Force on Oregon Shellfish. This is kind of a from our last meeting and from the information that we've gathered so far, task force objectives and a tentative work plan. So I'd like to take a moment and do a couple of things. We'll just take a look through this from the legislation that passed that formed the task force. This is just a plan that we would like to walk through and make sure that everybody understands it, see where we can find those of you who are interested in working in particular areas, priority areas for research and funding. So that's a key thing I'd like you all to be thinking about as we move through here. Then I'd like to touch on tentative dates for future meetings and wrap up with, after you've had some time to think about this and we walk through it, decide kind of where you can best use your skills and the expertise that you bring to help move this process forward. And I want to make note that we have a sign-up sheet in the room for updates. I believe it's right over here. For those of you who are here as guests, you can sign up to e-subscribe on OLIS, or if you put your information down here, you will continue to get email updates about what this task force is doing, when our next meetings are, how we're drilling down into the work that we want to do to move this task force forward and come out with a work product in September that we can use as a proposal into the 17 session. So on that note, let's go back to the task force document, start with objectives, and just walk through this. As we put this together after the last meeting, the things that came to light were a strategy for supporting and encouraging collaboration. And I'm very interested in how we want to move towards how all of these entities, agencies, industries work together in the long run to move this objective forward. So I'd like to have a discussion about that. And is there, and Dan's going to take very good notes. Do we have a sense at this point in time, which is very early on, about how we may begin to move forward towards encouraging collaboration between all of these entities?
Yes, I can add one point. When I was looking at the first draft, I wanted to add back that word, or that phrase, facilitated by extension activities. That phrase was in House Bill 2209. And so I think at that time, as we were crafting that, we had identified a mechanism to move forward, looking for some facilitation skills and assistance from extension, meaning Oregon Superintendent Extension, I believe.
Senator.
One of the other things where you mentioned extension that I think we shouldn't lose track of is that later on in the objectives, we talk about what resources may be necessary. I think we ought to bear in mind that whatever is identified as a lead agency may also be tasked with seeking out grants. There may be federal grants. I'm not sure that that's work that is ideally suited to agencies, although they do that. But having the opportunity to work with Extension and the statewides, I think, maybe maximizes our external fundraising opportunities. You can have all the collaboration in the world. If you don't have enough money to push something over the finish line, it doesn't really matter.
That's right. And you also have to have that go-to point person who's going to bring it all together so we can target what those grants are. So, yes?
Yeah, I just had a question. Are there people on the phone listening in as well that need to be introduced? Or,
I don't. Is there anyone on the phone at this point in time?
Not yet. We'll have to.
At 11:30, I believe we will have folks from
Margaret.
Yeah, we will have Margaret and Peter joining us on the phone at 11:30. I think the line is open now in case anyone wants to jump in early, but it's, I don't think, do we expect anyone between now and 11:30? Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Sorry.
So any other thoughts as we, you know, begin to move towards putting some meat around this, looking at extension, looking at the agencies as to how you all think it might best accomplish that. Yes?
You might want to consider a more formal organization to continue the work afterwards that can bring people together. And let's say, for example, in the absence of a strong, let's say, industry organization, how do we facilitate the collaboration? And that could be done through not only just meetings, but, you know, key workshops on key items that we want to support, looking at pulling teams together to go after key grants and research projects, but probably doing it, and so this is a question of informal versus formal,
mm-hmm.
and whether we would want a formal organization to, at least at the beginning of this, to nurture this along it for its first few years.
That also, though, is going to call out for increased collaboration. I tend to subscribe to your line of thinking, and I think that's what Washington has done, although I have a real paucity of information about Washington. But one of the things that's missing, and maybe it's just because I have crab quiche on my breath, or maybe it's because I'm looking at Pacific Seafood T-shirts, is that I see a lot of emphasis on production and ocean conditions, propagation. What I don't see is any relationship with processing. And absent a vigorous commercial application of the bounty of our oceans, I think we're like one hand clapping. And you're going to hear more from me on that subject as we get into this afternoon's presentation. I have been on a tear during the last three legislative days in what I believe to be an existential threat to seafood processing on the Oregon coast, and that is new rule promulgation by DEQ. and the absence of a plan and the absence of industry participation. I don't want to get my rant started too early because I've been sort of saving up for it for later. But
there are those of us who will join you in the rant, Senator.
I believe it to be an existential threat to seafood processing in Oregon. And I'd like to at least acknowledge that if we have the bounty of our oceans, what do we do with it? How do we maximize it for the benefit of Oregonians?
Any other thoughts? This is a very high-level discussion on where we're headed, but we need to begin to narrow this down. So any other thoughts on how this collaboration piece could possibly move forward as we go through this process? Okay. So we'll take note of those.
I would like to ask our professional staff if they would to pilfer as much as you can from the state of Washington. I think they're slightly ahead of us, and there may be experts around this table who knows what who know what is happening in Washington to a greater degree than I. But if there are ideas or architectures for organization that we can steal from Washington, I'm perfectly happy to cherry pick their good ideas.
And Senator, that may be an opportunity when Margaret and Peter join us on the phone, because they have been working. Washington has an initiative, so they may be able to add some more detail for us as we move forward as to what they've already done.
Well, I think one of the things we wanted to get out of Washington's too is get the other end of it, get the processing end, to see how it's working at their end too, not just take their policy straight as it is, because there may be some things that aren't working that Sylvain's counterpart in Washington may have some input on as well.
I think the Washington one is it's less a bill and more of a
regulation.
It's not even, it's just kind of there. I feel it's more of a feel good thing. I think we have more substance behind it. We have the two of you with us here doing this. We have an incredible coastal caucus behind us. We have agencies involved. They're not doing this.
Wow, okay. But if we do have questions about Washington that are specific, that we may be able to.
I know the second stage that they just initiated, you know, there's no funding, there's no request for funding, there's nothing.
And thank you.
For Dan's sake, I'd be more than happy, since I'm on the PCSPA as well, and we're a big part of that. I can work with you and Margaret if you'd like.
Great. That would be helpful. We just want to make sure we're not reinventing something we don't need to, but we want some substance to come out of this. And again, you know, the Coastal Caucus is very interested in supporting what we end up doing.
If I might add one thing I think about regarding collaboration as we go more specifically into these issues, and they're highlighted in some regards under the item 3 in terms of research and funding and such, but under each of those specific issues, I think we should keep going back and think about collaboration and flesh out who may be, good partners and good collaborators on each of these specific issues. So I think it'll be something we'll dive back into repeatedly as we go through these other concerns.
What I'm hearing you say is we want collaboration at the top of everything that we do.
I think basically that's the way to look at it, sure.
I see people nodding in agreement. Let's move on to number 2. One of our objectives will be to come up with recommendations regarding which state is the lead agency and is best suited to serve as that lead agency for addressing and regulating shellfish production in Oregon, and recommendations for legislative or agency actions that may be required. That is a work in progress. I think at the end of the day, we will need to come up with something that works through this collaborative process to make sure that somebody's basically in charge. And I'd love to know what your thoughts are at this point in time as we work towards some sort of a recommendation at the end.
Anybody but DEQ.
My question would be to Frank and Alex. I feel like in my conversation with Peter Moore, isn't it already in statute pretty much that ODA is the lead agency already?
And pretty much for the health issues on that health and sanitation.
Even the plat permitting and the final application approval comes from ODA.
Except you raise a very important point, and this is one of these examples, at least in my opinion, of a lot of overlap, where we've got little pockets of activities in various agencies, and if in fact this is an important part of Oregon's economy and our character and our coastal communities, I'd like to put all these activities in one place. So it's one point shopping. We've got DSL in the mix. We've got Ag in the mix. We conceivably have ODF&W in the mix.
DEQ.
And that ends up with no accountability, everybody going like this, and we have a chance now to reshape the playing field, and I would like to at least explore putting the authority in Department of Ag and stop all this interagency bickering and who trumps who and how does somebody make their way through the bureaucratic morass, plus maybe we'll save a little money if we don't have this obscene duplication in agency land.
Well, this also falls, you know, kind of the same things we're facing with dredging, where we're having so many different agencies involved. And, you know, we'd identified at one point that, you know, these ports are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars just for the permitting process, which could very easily happen down this road. When we'd identified a bunch of state agencies have the ability to do a bunch of that for us instead of being more so regulatory, be more of an assistant or partner in some of this stuff, and I think this is a perfect opportunity to put some of that into play.
Well, and there's the precedent in how we have managed the general permit for dredging through the Corps by creating the coalitions North and South and going to that the general permit process. So we've set the standard in the last couple of years.
So this has a lot of the same characteristics, in my opinion.
So, Senator, maybe this is something we need to pursue. This is unique, but can we do it not just at the federal level? Can we do this at the state level?
I'd love to do that. I would like to task the professional staff again, if they wouldn't mind taking another assignment, in identifying all of those different pockets so that we're not running anecdotally on what I remember or can think of, but rather to actually have you go through and see which agencies have any kind of regulatory engagement with shellfish production and processing.
Is the Corps involved at all, too?
It's a whole... I would apply to ODA, and then ODA does a public notice or sends out letters to ODF&W, the Corps, and then I believe they then respond with opinions or ESAs or... And Steve probably knows a lot more about this.
Yes, if I can add to it. So the Oregon Department of Agriculture, through the John Mohl report, we just went through this. So we do have a mature report that we just took a look at the whole scope of state-level regulation. So we can just incorporate that right in and take a look at the analysis.
Who did the report?
So
that report was done to basically as a roadmap to figure out how to get through the process for marine aquaculture in the state. And so he was funded through ODA to develop this report.
And who's the he?
John
Mohl.
And he identifies all the different state agencies involved in the permitting process and how you get from the beginning to the end point of a...
And magically, here it is. Developing additional investment in aqua farming. We might want to think about a different title there. In Oregon, a roadmap for sustainable development. Could you get this disseminated to the committee?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
Cool.
But if it's an example of, you know, how we may craft something, that might be a great place to start. Ms. Goldfarb.
Gabriella Goldfarb, Governor's Office. I just wanted to provide background that Director Koba convened a working group on aquaculture that focused on inland aquaculture and marine shellfish. Two subgroups formed. Your own Cassina Lee at that point helped coordinate that marine shellfish group. And it was one of those conversations that your legislation I think had a lot of input and good ideas, and at the top of the list for that group was developing this regulatory roadmap to at least identify what the path is and try to make it clearer, and then as a foundation for then figuring out how to work more effectively.
So, is there a work product out of that yet? Is there?
So that's the work. That's the first work product. That's what has come out, and they had a gap in staffing at ODA that has been filled recently, and that group just convened this week or is convening
last
next week.
Last week.
Just convened last week to restart with new staff staff person at ODA driving that.
Well, that sort of begs the question right there. We've got this initiative, and then Director Koba has an initiative. Are we operating in two parallel universes, or?
And Senator, I think that came about in the first few meetings we had when we were developing the bill to create this task force, and it was keeping aquaculture separate from mariculture. And there was, I think, a good reason for that at the time, that we didn't want to blur those lines between the two. And it sounds like when we moved down one direction, Director Koba took the aquaculture down a different direction.
Yeah, the regulatory path, a lot of it is the same, so it's a resource for both paths. This document is a resource for both the marine shellfish and for inland aquaculture.
Okay, I'm still confused. So Director Koba is just doing inland aquaculture, or is she involved in marine as well?
As you identified, the ODA has a primary role in this, and that will continue. Cognizant of this legislation and this group's work, the ODA, I think, stands ready to implement and support, you know, whatever the legislature ends up adopting as a result of recommendations of this group. So I think hopefully the takeaway message is that collaboration that you're asking about, bringing everybody to the table to figure out who has what piece, that work has been started, and there's some information that's a resource for you all. I think you all have a much more focused lens on marine shellfish and what specifically will benefit marine shellfish, and that's what you know, we expect to have the legislature consider for 17.
So at a subsequent meeting, it may be wise for us to bring in Director Koba and have her update us on what is happening in the inland aquaculture world and see how that may dovetail with what we're trying to do. Does that sound reasonable? And I sat through 2 years of Ag and Natural Resource Committee meetings when the specter of finfish aquaculture on the marine environment was discussed, and there was a great deal of pushback. The inland aquaculture is a different animal, no pun intended, but I think that's why there was some differentiation and some separation, because there was some concern about the finfish aquaculture on the marine side of things. Am I characterizing that correctly?
No, you're exactly correct. That was a big concern, and we did not want to lose some momentum there by blending them together.
That's right.
And losing some sight of how this would go forward. So it was Director Koba's whole focus was to separate those out so that we would not end up with a discussion that would damage both sides.
Which I think was probably wise on her part.
I do think it was a wise way for us to go on this, yes. Right. We keep the discussion separate.
So shall we ask the director to join us in our next meeting for an update on how they're doing? And there may be some opportunities for us to dovetail. Okay? All right. Any other thoughts on the lead state agency objective that we have been tasked with? All right, let's move on to number three. Recommendations for priorities for research and research funding. And they're related to a number of fields. And we're just at the very beginning stages of starting to work through things. Some of the things we have already provided funding for, they are works that are in progress. And I think what I'd like to do is just briefly go through, have people comment on things that they are involved in or working on, but then also have people look at this with an eye towards where you might best want to use your expertise should we break down into kind of some smaller task-oriented committees as we move forward. I'm just going to throw these out, and we can have conversations about one of our brave objectives here. One of our number one objectives is to help enhance shellfish production through site suitability research. You can read this: prioritizing pilot projects that focus on enhancing existing certified areas, look at areas that haven't been certified. This is an area we're going to take a peek at.
I'd like to add something, and I'm going to turn to colleagues at the Department of Ag because you know more about this than I. But how the reservation of plats are used, and I'm not saying this very artfully, it is my impression, but not my knowledge, that there may be plat opportunities that have been reserved for some period of time but are not in production, or can be held in a almost monopoly. How up to date are the statutes and the rules that govern the opportunity to do production?
Hey, do they expire?
Actually, they stay until people are either sell them or go into some sort of inheritance type situation. There's some that are just out there that have been sitting there for quite a while that have never been utilized in any way, shape, or form. People just hold on to them because they have had them in their possession for such a long period of time. They don't push them forward. We've had issues with some of the actual surveys being often and not in good shape. And with modern technology, we're finding different situations where we can actually clean some of that up. But
so updating the surveys is something we might want to have some focus on.
Very important to us, but this again causes some legal issues.
I think that's an area that's just begging for review, and that these can be passed as part of an estate. I mean, these are a public asset. I don't know how refreshed any of those statutes or rules are. And certainly, if you don't have the foundational information like accurate surveys, that's an invitation for litigation. So we ought to flag that both for the administrative work, but also for adequate money.
And I'm looking at the industry guys. What do you know about this?
I'll use Tillamook as an example. There was one individual that his family held the majority of, I'm going to say it was somewhere right around 2,000 acres in various plats. And Pacific recently, a couple years ago, was able to purchase some of those leases from that person, but he still holds a lot of them. They're not in production. The way, and I don't know if this might be part of your question too, is every quarter, any plat holder from ODA, and ports might be different on how they pay and charge, but we pay a set amount per acre that we lease from the state based on if it's in a production area or approved or unapproved area. And then there's certain areas that are only approved part of the year, so you pay less for those. And then you also pay per bushel you harvest or per gallon you sell from your farm or per dozen you sell from farm. So that's how ODA gets there. And if I remember right, the regulations governing that and your lease is as long as you are paying your per acre fee, you don't actually have to have it in production. And
yeah, it's still, I mean, the rule in the statute is pretty explicit, and I don't think we need to revisit that. It's more a situation that we've triaged, where we, you know, send our efforts and our money. These places, it's not a huge issue, but there are instances where we have people that, as Frank was saying, they have a lease, they want to keep it in perpetuity in their family, they don't want other people out there in front of their property doing stuff. So they pay the fee every year, and then they keep it. We do have the power to go and look at their production records over the previous years, and if they're not, we do have a use it or lose it clause.
Okay.
But it's just a matter of that we haven't really gone after those people, started the documentation paperwork to say, you know, it's been 5 years and you guys haven't done a darn thing on this property, we're pulling it. We just haven't gone there. Just kind of been low on the...
And I guess as a grower, my concern would be not that I think ODA is going to do that, but as a grower, you work in 2 to 3 year cycles, so there may be a period where you don't use a certain plat. Because even within our 1,000 acres, there's 10 different numbered plats that you're paying on.
Growing at different
cycles, or maybe you're not using this, you're going to expand into that in the next 5 years. So there, we have to leave ODA some discretion, obviously, to look at what the plan is for the future.
Mr. Barcelos, right now it's a five-year window.
Yeah, and
is that a statute that needs to be revisited for some reason? Should it be two growing cycles, or should it be six, or should it be 10, or should it be? I'm asking.
It is one of those things we need to look, and this is something that the industry, okay, the growers would really have to be a part of this, because this is not something that we look at normally, but we do see this wait period, and we do understand that their need to change in those plats all the time. And that's one of the reasons why this has never been really looked at in the past. We don't want to go out there and all of a sudden you use it or lose it kind of philosophy, because then we put everybody up on ear. So it's not something we want to.
And there's also, is there an interest, even if they were to use the clause, is there an interest of somebody wanting the property? Or does this ODA or state then lose that income because nobody's even paying the basic fee?
There needs to be a way to identify those that are just sitting on plats for years and years and years, and those that have them part of their cycle. So there's got to be some way to identify an active grower who's using this plat as part of their cycle versus those legacy ones that are sitting just because they don't want to.
There's also what would be the grower fear of once that master plat is removed from an individual, it's null and void. So anybody that wants that plat next would have to go through the whole process again, and would incur all of the public input and hearings and permitting and conditions and Army Corps, DEQ. Everybody would then
weigh in. So the way that we've tried to approach this normally is that, you know, if we are aware of the industry knows that there's someone out there that has a plat, that they would be interested in using actively, then we encourage the industry to go to the individual
and work a deal. Yeah.
Work a deal, because, as you know, like Sven was saying, you know, we can pull that plat, but then that plat, that's just gone forever now. And so then, if someone wants to go back into that land and they start from scratch,
well, what I'm hearing is, Mr. Anderson.
I was going to add that it sounds like there's a lot of question about which plats are being used, which are not being used. It'd be great if we had a summary, at least on a bay by bay assessment, as to, you know, what are the acres under lease currently, which ones, how much is being actively used. We don't need to know who owns or uses. We don't need to get into the individual concerns. But I think there's been considerable change in the estuaries over time, certainly since some of these areas were platted, and it would give all of us, I think, a framework to work from, and that would help us understand what's the current resource out there, what are these conditions that we're looking at, and maybe we could offer some guidelines forward from that.
I guess my question would be, Mr. Barcelos, can you provide us with that information? Does DSL provide us with that information? Do we have the capability of asking for that in the next couple of meetings if we could get that?
We do, and we are doing the billing on these plats, so we have that information. We should have a pretty good list of at least what we're sending out billing for, so that is about the most.
And you would know what's in production and what's not as well?
I don't know that we'll know everything, but I think we can get that information to you.
So I'd like to ask staff to work with you. Okay. Maybe, I don't know what time frame you need to gather that information, but for either the third meeting or the fourth meeting, if we could have that in front of us.
Okay.
What might come up missing is anything owned privately or by courts, like Port of Coos Bay. Mm-hmm. That's not going to be on ODA's list.
But can we direct staff to query ports to find out what they're leasing to as well? That shouldn't be that difficult. Good morning, Mr. Thomas. Thank you for joining us. We're glad you're here.
Thank you.
We are on the first page of the task force objectives. We're just working through a conversation about these objectives. Any other questions about 3.1? Any other information you all would like to see us gather for our consideration?
If this is a great idea to get these maps together, will the maps layer the value or the productivity of these areas? You were just suggesting, Sven, that depending on their productivity, that they have a different market price. So is that part of what's on these maps? Do we understand that or not?
We would report to ODA whatever either bushels of oysters, gallons of oysters, or dozens of oysters came off any particular plat. I do not believe ODA can legally release that data per plat.
So you can't color code the level of revenue or something?
Not on a per plat basis, because that would be able to trace back to the individual owner of that lease.
So one question
as
where
overall,
I'm going with
yes,
this.
You could say this bay produced X volume, but you couldn't do it on a per plat, if I understand the statute correctly.
On your quarterly billing, though, you're saying production per plate.
Right, but I don't believe ODA is allowed to release that.
No, he's talking about releasing it
in aggregate. Right. It has to be released in aggregate. It can't be released and say Pacific grew this, Hayes grew this, Boston grew this.
Well, where I'm going with this is if there are unused plats, then the question is why? And is it because of lower productivity or people are speculating or, as you say, they don't want anyone in front of their property?
Right.
But I am curious, as we work toward a final product here, I think one of our goals is how to increase production and productivity. So these maps could be very useful in helping understand what the potentials are across the different estuaries. So the extent that we have that information, I think it would be helpful for these discussions.
I can probably
I would imagine you could put up at least a percentage of, say, Tillamook, there's 3,000 platted acres, only X percent is recording any production, so that leaves X percent out of production.
That's one thing you could do. If you do.
Where it's still kind of a group thing, but not identifying individuals.
I think I can answer your question, too, is why some plats aren't getting used. It's the same thing. I mean, you see it in ports with mooring slips and a bunch of spots. When people get the foot in the door, they don't want to give it up. So sometimes these legacy families will have something, and they'd rather pay every year because they know if they get out of it, they may never be able to get back into it. So, I mean, we have that with slips and docks. They might not put a boat in it for 5 years and don't have any plans to do it, but they know if they give it up, they ain't going to ever get it back again.
Right.
So.
No, this is interesting because you can see that how do we align the incentives in terms of policy so we're making individuals in the market are making rational decisions about this. And if they're sitting on stuff or speculating on stuff that's not leading to greater production and value, then how do we address that in a way that brings greater
Yeah, anything
a
like
very important question for this group and how we move forward with this recommendation.
We would, I mean, I know there's plats in Tillamook that we have approached the current plat holders on even subleasing from them or something to get in production. It is good ground, and they just don't want to.
Well, again, looking outside the industry, because I keep going back to the port issue, but, I mean, we had the same thing with slips, and we had to put a new ordinance in place saying that you are expected to use it within, you know, have a boat more than that slip at least once a year, and if it remains unused for 2 years with no boat in the slip, you're going to get a revolt. So, you know, it's kind of tough, but we had to do it because we know we're still getting the revenue from the slip, just like the state's still getting the revenue from the plat, but if it's not producing, they're not eating in our restaurants, they're not doing all this.
Right.
So
the economic impact is significant.
It's huge.
We had two of our vessels in Tillamook on a waiting list for 2 years.
I want to take a time check because we are now 10 minutes behind schedule and we're only through number 3.1. So I want to very quickly go through the next step because I want to be very deferential to the folks who are here to present to us today. I guess what I want to glean from this is you all know where your areas of expertise are. We have two or three people here who are knowledgeable about this. Dr. Rumrill just showed me the statutes. They are there. I think we need to visit them. But coming out of this, I'd like to pull two or three people together who have interest and expertise in this particular issue, and let's get some work done in between to bring to us something at our next meeting that helps educate us about where we may be able to go with this. So I'm going to move on to 3.2, best management practices. This is a very large topic. But it's part of our charge developing those best management practices through these cooperative efforts, and we want to stay in the cooperation and collaboration mode here to identify planning actions and techniques. We also, Senator, we put money into ocean acidification work in the last session. I think we need to learn more about that. And do we want to recommend that more money go into that continued research as time goes on as part of this initiative?
Can I answer that right now?
Yes.
So we put money in. We
and
didn't
how much
put it,
and how
we
far
didn't
are we
put
going?
Enough in, and I mean, this too is existential. I remember when Whiskey Creek Hatchery shut down and there were no larvae from British Columbia to Mexico, and it was OSU that pulled their chestnuts out of the fire. I mean, this is pretty serious stuff, and I think it shouldn't be an afterthought.
We also committed during the design of the task force to look at the socioeconomic and social impacts of this industry. We're all talking about that. Is our plats that aren't productive, obviously they're not having a great socioeconomic impact on our coastal communities. How do we deal with that? This is all part of this conversation moving forward. It's how we encourage production. Water quality, we have a test in place in Tillamook. Anxious to know how that is going. We have already invested in that. One of the decisions we're going to make is once this pilot is done, we need to see the impact that that had on the industry and getting production going a little quicker after events. And is it successful? And if it is part of this initiative going to be to make that the law of the land that we're going to spend more money doing testing to get people open quicker once we have weather events? Number 3.6 is assessing the wild shellfish stocks. So those are the things that we have in our task force objectives. And I think what I'd like to wrap up really quickly so we can get on with the next part of our agenda is look to all of you before we leave this meeting to kind of identify the areas that you have expertise and would like to work in so that we can bring back some information to our next meeting and begin over the next couple of meetings to start crafting a more clear direction as to where we want this task force to go. Does that sound like a reasonable way to wrap up this segment? And if there's anything else to add, please do so.
Are you looking for people to volunteer for the different sections now, or?
Why don't you hold off till we get to the end? And then, at the end of the day, what I would like is people to kind of self-direct as to where you think your expertise is best used and how we move these objectives forward. Senator, do you have anything to add?
No.
Okay. Then, and then we have, of course, other issues related to shellfish production. That's other duties as assigned. So, strategies for funding. I think we will move along with that as we get closer to what our recommendation will be at the end. And we do have a list up here of potential task force subgroups. I want you to take a look at that, and they're broken into five areas. And if you would like, I might have staff just put each one of those at the top of a piece of paper, send it around, and people can kind of give us an idea of where you want to participate. Would that be amenable to everyone?
The one thing that's worrisome to me is if we break into these subgroups, what's the point of coordination so that we don't have some of them wandering off into the woods by themselves? Will there be report outs to the committee of the whole, or how will that work?
I'm looking for suggestions here.
I would suggest we do this at PCSJ often. We break into subcommittees, but it only works if you appoint an in-charge person or chair of that subcommittee.
We can make that happen.
That way that person has the directive to report back to the whole.
And we'll put a time frame on, depending on and we're going to look at scheduling before we get out of here to see how we're going to schedule to that September 15th deadline. So,
my other question would be, would those subgroups be open to non-task force members? Because Nathan may be available when I'm not, or Steve may have somebody in his office that is better suited to be part of one of those subgroups.
I am a great proponent of doing that and leave it to the discretion of the chair of the subgroups. There may be experts they want to call in episodically. There may be somebody who wasn't included in this group who has a great deal to offer. I'd leave it to the discretion of the committee chair.
You look around here, there's a lot of resources behind us that could have knowledge that could be
used. The one caveat, though, is that if any of these get unbalanced in terms of the prism that they're looking at their assignment through, then I think we do the whole enterprise a disservice. I would hate to see a chair load up a perspective on a subcommittee and have it report out a foregone conclusion.
I think, Senator, you and I can take the lead in making sure that that doesn't occur when we look at the we could ask for who are you bringing to the table.
I think who's at the table is incredibly important, and I would like to respectfully ask a copy of the committee that Director Kobus put together. I have a high degree of confidence in Director Kobus' ability to balance competing interests, but I'd still like to see that list.
Okay. I'm seeing some, then I'm not seeing these. we are going to have to move on.
Yeah.
We're 20 minutes late now.
Yeah, so will the task force, will they have their responsibilities spelled out to them? So are they coming back with a set of recommendations, draft recommendations to the rest of the committee? Or are they just doing a general discussion of what issues are
right? This task force is going to make the recommendation to the legislature as to how we move forward. I would suggest that these subgroups come back to this group
right.
with, I would say, general recommendations. They aren't written in stone. This task force, which is carefully designed, is going to have to come forward with this recommendation. So the subgroups, the way I see it, can come to this group, provide information, give suggestions, and then this task force will have to,
leave each meeting with an assignment. Like first, yeah. When we leave here, we're going to go do a little bit of research, and then the next meeting we'll report what the research was, and then we'll leave and come up with recommendations, come back to the follow-up. You know, it's pretty simple.
Everybody
okay.
good?
Okay.
All right. I apologize, but I want to make sure that we are very respectful of our presentations that are coming. So we're going to move on to our shellfish science and research portion of our meeting. And I would first like to invite Chris Langdon, who is professor of fisheries at Oregon State University, to enlighten us. Nice to have you here, sir. It's a pleasure. I hope this was interesting. It gives you some background as to what we're trying to do.
So let's see if we can get this computer to work. I'm a Mac user, so I'm always cautious of these PCs. So what I thought I'd do, I think I have about 15 minutes, is give you a sort of an overview of the kind of research that's been done here at Packwood Center on shellfish. I'm not going to talk about dolphs, so if you have questions on dolphs, I'll answer them another time. So a little bit of history. The Hapford Center here and research by OSU had a long, long history working with industry, going back over 75 years. So the head of my department of fisheries at OSU started a small research facility up the bay here. And then, of course, the Hapford Center was established in the early 80s, oh, sorry, in the 60s. And very soon after that, a whole cluster of researchers started working on shellfish research as well as other types of aquaculture. This was sort of the glory days, if you like, of aquaculture. And then since then, we've had a much less investment in aquaculture research at the center, but shellfish aquaculture has been still very much front and center. And these are some of the present collaborators here who work with me on
Dr.
shellfish.
It would be very helpful if, when you say it's not as robust now as it was in the halcyon days, it would be lovely to have a list, your dream list, of what you would have money for and what the outcome would be. I'll just use acidification. I mean, that one's pretty obvious. You're doing the work. Give us this much more money, and we can do this. If you'd give us your wish list, that'd be fabulous.
But prior to that, Dr. Langdon, the staff has asked me to ask you to pick up the mic. This is being archived,
okay.
And so we do need to record your comments, if you don't mind.
Okay. If I can get this mic off.
Unleash the mic for him,
yeah,
please.
Here we are.
thank you. All right. Thank you, Dr. Langdon.
Thank you. So just to give you a sort of an overhead view of the Hatfield Center here, I can get my big stick out now. So we have a remarkable facility here. We have a large series of labs here at the center, but these labs here are the ones that were actually built in the early 80s specifically for aquaculture. It's called the Newport Aquaculture Laboratory. And these facilities are absolutely unique on the West Coast and I think probably nationally. The building is owned by NOAA, and OSU leases space within that building.
We pump our seawater from the Aquinnah at high tide, and we have some storage tanks here. So these storage tanks provide seawater to the whole facility, and the seawater is a high salinity and a very good quality. So this just gives you an idea of the complexity of our seawater system. It requires a tremendous amount of input and investment over the years, and obviously quite a lot of maintenance in order to keep it all working. So we've, as I mentioned, had a long history working with the Pacific oyster industry. My predecessor, Willie Breeze, and Anya Robinson, Bob Maloof, were really instrumental in setting up the modern-day hatchery, the shellfish hatchery technology here on the West Coast back in the 70s. And we have now a facility, Whiskey Creek Hatchery, here's Mark Weigert, which really is the sort of the center of sea production for a lot of the small oyster farmers on the West Coast. The other two big hatcheries, Coast Oyster and Taylor Hatchery, their primary goal is to supply their own companies with seed, and if they have extra seed, they give it, we'll sell it to the other members of the industry. But this is an independent hatchery, and this has also been the focus of some of the work on ocean acidification. So just to give you an overview of how important oysters are, this is actually from the report that we were just discussing earlier, John Moll's report that was funded by ODA. And if we look at the relative number of aquafarms or the relative value of aquaculture in this state, oysters really are by far the most important economically, about 10 million oysters produced each year from about 17 operating farms. So I've been sort of since about the mid-90s leading a breeding program for Pacific oysters, and this is really the one of the major sort of areas of research here in my program. It was initiated by combined efforts of Senator Hatfield and Laverne Weber in the days when one could have what was called pork barrel special projects from Congress. And
earmarks,
yes.
We liked them so much.
They were very helpful for this particular project. And this of course, ended in, I think, 2011. And 2012, industry and the little later the state of Oregon came forward with some additional funding. So we've been able to maintain the breeding program over these years. We also have, and Brett Dumbolt's going to give a little talk later on, we also have some investment by USDA ARS program here. So they have two research positions here. One is on ecology and one is on genetics. The genetics one is currently unfilled, but they hope to fill that in the near future. This is the pedigree of the MBP. You can see we've maintained about 1,500 families over. We've tested 1,500 families over this space of time, many, many cohorts, which represent about 50 to 100 families. And these are planted at commercial sites, farm sites up and down the coast.
Dr. Langdon, you're tracking these cohorts for what characteristics? Resilience to disease?
Yes, good question. So the primary focus of MBP was initially to improve yields of Pacific oysters. So we measured how many kilograms we obtain per bag, and then we also included survival and growth of the oysters. So the primary focus was just looking at the performance of the cohorts after they had left the hatchery. So from seed, that's baby spat, all the way through to harvest. So that was the primary focus up until the problems we had with the hatcheries. So this is a kind of a summary of our results from the breeding program, just looking at gains in yield and survival of MBP stocks. And you can see over this time period, there's a gradual improvement in yields in terms of genetic gain. and in survival, realized heritability, which is basically how it differs from wild stocks, is a little more variable for yield, but consistent improvement with survival. So the breeding program is working. It's very gradual improvement, and I think that's because we're not breeding chickens or tilapia, things where you can add feed and manipulate the environment, control the environment. We're dealing with a very wild environment. We can't control the nutrition of these animals. And they've been exposed every year in every different site to a whole range of different stresses.
Dr. Langdon, what is VLUP, please?
Oh, that is a scientific term that's used to describe the genetic component of an improved trait. So it combines the genetic input of not just the family or the cohort you're looking at, but all the relations of those individuals or families.
Question?
Yeah.
Are these triploids or diploids?
No,
or both?
They're diploids.
All right.
So we have not worked on triploids in the breeding program.
Okay, for the history majors in the room, what are you talking about?
Well, the diploids are like everyone else in the room here. They're the more natural type of shellfish, where they have two sets of chromosomes. What geneticists have been able to do is increase the number of sets of chromosome by one. So they have three sets of chromosomes. And this isn't genetic engineering, because we're not adding any foreign genes or anything like that. We're just manipulating the number of chromosomes. So this method has been used a lot on the East Coast with eastern oysters. And it's been used a lot now on the West Coast. So about half, for example, of Taylor's production is triploid oysters, and only the other half is diploid. The reason people are very interested in triploids is because the animals don't become as reproductive in the summer as diploids, and so they don't get spawny, and they don't get soft. And so you can sell the animals throughout the summer when diploids are not very marketable. And the other advantage is that under some conditions, the triploids grow much faster because they're not putting all that energy into reproduction. So an oyster can lose about a third of its body weight every time it spawns. And when those eggs and sperm release from the animal obviously loses weight. And so,
Doctor, isn't this a technique they use with fish?
Yes.
Also?
Yes. It sterilizes the animal, basically. And so the industry has been very happy with our product. So here are some testimonies from different folks. And one of the interesting things which people have noted from some of the companies is that the larvae have performed much better from MBP in terms of setting. So the hatcheries, what they do is they raise the larvae, and then they send the eyed larvae to growers, and then the growers set those larvae. Those larvae are metamorphosed and attached to shell, and then they're spread out over the intertidal. And so the folks have noticed that the larvae are much better from MBP stocks. And then in 2006, late 2006, 2007, most of you know there was a change in ocean conditions which led to some very serious problems here on the West Coast in terms of larval production. All of a sudden, the major hatcheries, not only actually here in Oregon at Whiskey Creek, but also at Taylor's, which was inland, had major problems producing seed. And initially there was a lot of concern about what the cause of this problem was. In fact, we here at MBP, we saw problems in 2005, and we spent a lot of effort and a lot of money thinking that it was related to either water quality or bacterial types of pathogens. The really troubling part is that not only were the hatcheries impacted, but there was also a period of time when there was very little commercial set of larvae in Willapa Bay, which is the main source of seed, or a main source of seed for the oyster industry. So the oyster industry went through this seed crisis, and it's still actually in a situation where seed availability is limiting. Unless at the very soon after this was noticed, that this seed crisis occurred, this very important paper came out by Dick Feely and NOAA, where he reported acidified water being drawn onto the coastal shelf. And this water is acidified and has what's called lower aragonite saturation state. So it means that the larval shells will tend to dissolve more readily. So Iria here will talk a little more about this in a talk after myself, so I'm not going to belabor it too much. But there is also, apart from this effect of upwelling, there is also an overall baseline effect of increasing ocean acidification as our concentrations of atmospheric CO2 dissolve, increase, and that CO2 dissolves in seawater. So one of the questions we had, and this is part of the funding that we received from the state of Oregon as well as support from Oregon Sea Grant, is to try and find out if MBP larvae were better or more resistant to the effects of acidified water than wild larvae. And we did these under laboratory conditions here at the center. So this year we're going to do some work up at Whiskey Creek, but this last year we did it just in the Hatfield Center. And we found what other people have found, and we've seen it many times, that initially when the larvae develop their shell, they're severely impacted by ocean acidified water. And in fact, in this case, the MBP larvae did more poorly than the larvae from the wild. However, after a period of about 22 days of growth, when we measured spat setting, so how many spat did you obtain from a set number of eggs, we found that the MBP larvae from the MBP stocks did much better than the larvae from the wild stocks. And what you see under acidified condition is much more variability in the performance of the wild. So this is probably explained some of the problems that the hatcheries have had, where there's a lot of tanks that crash under acidified conditions. Some of these replicate containers here in the lab failed. Now, I want to mention that this, reiterate and strongly emphasize that this was work that was done in our laboratory. It is not necessarily representative of what's going on in the hatchery up in Whiskey Creek, because they have very different conditions, in that what we were doing in our labs is we were just manipulating the acidified water by bubbling with CO2, whereas in Whiskey Creek is dealing with upwell water, and that upwell water has other characteristics of it that make it different. We also had very different sort of feeding conditions in our facilities, but at least under our laboratory conditions, we can show that MBP larvae do better than larvae from the wild, which is really encouraging. And it probably reflects the fact we've been selecting unintentionally healthier, more robust larvae over the 20 years or so of selection in MBP. And we can see that in the way they perform. Mark Weigert has also noted improved performance of MBP larvae, and this kind of confirms it. So another big problem we're having in the future is global warming and effects on water temperature. So this last summer we had a warm blob offshore with temperatures of about 2.5 degrees higher than the average from 81 to 2011. It's just a paper in Nature Climate Change just came out this week indicating that the oceans of the world are warming up at a faster rate than originally anticipated, and the rate is accelerating. So the oceans absorb about 90% of the heat generated because of global warming. And so what we've done as part of this is collect oysters from the southern part of Japan. So these are waters that are semi-subtropical. Waters reach about 30 degrees centigrade in the summer. Most of our stocks that we currently grow are from northern Japan, a Miyagi strain from Sendai originally. So we went and collected some from southern Japan. Now, with the idea that these stocks might in the future help us get over some of these or address some of these problems with global warming, we were able to do this because we had the facilities here to bring in animals from a different country and hold them for a whole generation under quarantine conditions. So these facilities here again at the Hatfield Center allow us to do this. It's a unique facility. You don't find anything like that anywhere around the country. We also did very extensive disease checking, not just looking at histology, but using modern genetic techniques that the ARS laboratory here, as well as other scientists at OSU, have the capability to carry out those genetic tests to look for diseases. So these animals passed all their tests and now are in production. So, for example, Whiskey Creek has used some of our Midori strains and Kumamoto strains for large-scale commercial production.
Dr. Langdon, how widely dispersed are they in production? How many estuaries are they in?
Well, the Kumamoto oysters are fairly limited in where they're grown. We have Oregon oyster up the river here using the Kumamoto. I don't know whether Pacific has used any of those. And then the Midoris have been tested out in California and in Puget Sound, as far as I know.
Thank you.
So what are the future strategies for MBP? We're going to obviously continue to maintain selection for high yields and survival, but also I think there's a niche market for boutique oysters, which have specific color and shape. And here are some examples here of different colors of oysters. We've found that color is heritable. We need to continue focusing on larval and spat survival under hatchery conditions, especially when they've been exposed to upwelling OA conditions. And we need to continue to evaluate the southern stocks for resilient to likely future conditions of high seawater temperature and OA conditions. So I want to just mention the work we've been doing also on native oyster restoration. And we've got two pieces of work, I think, that are really critical to understanding how restoration should be undertaken and what its goals should be. And we've worked in conjunction with Dick Vandershaft here in the Nature Conservancy on this project. And the first project was undertaken by David Stick, who's now graduated. He was a PhD student. This is very important work where he's looked at the genetic structure of populations of native oysters on the West Coast and identified which populations are genetically similar and which are different. And therefore, that's going to inform restoration efforts so that people who want to restore particular populations of oysters pick the appropriate brood stock. And then the second piece of work is done by Matt Gray, who's sitting in the corner there. What he's been looking at is what are the ecosystem services of native oysters? So a lot of people realize that bivalves, both Pacific oysters and native oysters, are really important in cleaning the water, filtering the water. And this is good for the environment because it allows your grass, for example, to grow. It clarifies the water. And he's carried out a lot of simulations and model development, working in conjunction with researchers at the University of Cambridge in England, as well as colleagues on the East Coast and at OSU. And this is just an example, looking at historic populations that were around before the main harvesting occurred. They have discovered that about 50% of the equina could have been filtered in summer, not so much filtered in the winter when there's much more fresh water flow through the estuary. But this is, I think, a first good piece of evidence, a hard scientific evidence that indicates that at least historic concentrations or densities of native oysters were important in terms of clearing the water column of suspended sediments. So in summary, we've got some really unique facilities here to do some very important work to ensure the future health and well-being of shellfish in the West Coast, not only for Pacific oysters, but also playing an important role in restoration efforts for native oysters. And I think we've got some big challenges ahead of us. The environment is going to become more and more difficult for oyster farmers in the future due to global warming and ocean acidification. And this work over the 2 decades or so wouldn't have been possible without a lot of players, and these are just some of them. But I want to emphasize all the various agencies that have been involved. So this is, I guess this is an example of collaboration amongst agencies, NOAA, USDA, state agencies, and also the Pacific Coast Shellfish Growers Association. So Margaret will talk a little bit about their association a little later this morning. And then we've been very closely knit with industry. So industry has provided a tremendous amount of support in many ways.
Dr. Langdon, I want to just take one or two minutes and wrap up and then move on. And we're going to change the agenda a little bit. Ms. Jimenez has agreed to provide her comments after lunch. We're going to move on to Brett Dumbald. But I would like to go back to Senator Johnson's question that she broached early on in your presentation, which was, if you were king of the world, what do you need to move this research forward?
Yeah. I think we've got a pretty good team in place, but funding is a problem. We have, you know, received very generous support from the state of Oregon to maintain the breeding program as well as continue the monitoring of acidification at the Hatfield Center, so Burke Hales and myself. additional funding would be very helpful in maintaining this program. To maintain a breeding program with the funding level we have is challenging, especially when major pieces of equipment break down and we don't have the funds to replace them.
Dr. Lyman, I'm going to interrupt and ask for more specificity. It's harder and harder for Representative McEwen and me to go to our legislative colleagues and say, give us more money. I want to know what you're buying. I want to know what you need to ensure that there's a deep bench of researchers. After you retire, you talked about your predecessors with reverence. Who takes over after you're gone? I'd like to know what equipment could be on the gravely ill list that might need to be replaced or has become antiquated. And the degree to which you can price those activities makes our job, I'm a budget writer in Ways and Means, makes my job a lot easier and makes Representative McEwen on the policy side a more rigorous advocate if we know what we're buying.
Good. Thank you. Yes, I would be happy to sit down and get my pencil out and, make a list.
Maybe not king of the world, prince. There is a terminus to how deep the pot
goes. I overspoke. But it's important for us to have those finite details, and we'll look forward to having you bring those to us as we move towards culmination of this process.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. And we appreciate your comments. And okay. We're gonna change our schedule a bit. This is fascinating. We're all engaged, and I don't want to miss anything. But I think what we're going to do is bring up Dr. Dumbald, and then we're going to ditch our break, and then we will move into the discussion. If you need to take a break, please feel free to get up, take a walk, grab some food, get a cup of coffee, and come back. I know that Ms. Barrett and Mr. Moore have a finite amount of time to join us between 11:30 and 12:30. So that's what we're going to do from here forward.
Is this 60? Sure. Why not? Get this right. Okay. I am Brett Dumbald. I'm an ecologist. I work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture for the Agriculture Research Service. And I've been here at the Hatfield Marine Science Center since about 2004 or five, I believe.
And I'm just going to talk about what our program, the USDA ARS Shellfish Aquaculture Research, here at Hatfield. And our purview is really the whole West Coast, but because we're located here at Hatfield, most of the work occurs on the Oregon coast, and for me, a lot has occurred in the Southwest Washington coast, too, so a lot of work in Willapaw Bay, in my case, in Southwest Washington. And our purview is, you know, all the shellfish, but a majority of our research occurs on oysters. You know, we have done a little bit on gooey ducks and some on clams as well in Washington. So we have, as Chris mentioned, actually, he sort of scooped me here, we have two programs here, one on genetics, oyster, shellfish genetics, and one on ecology, and that's sort of my purview, and two scientists. So the way ARS works is, broadly, we have two programs, a scientist and a technician assigned to both of them, sort of money for that. So this is the genetics program. It has some broad goals. Chris has already sort of mentioned these, and really the reason we're here at Hatfield is because of the program, the MVP program that Chris already described, really, because that it was the only breeding program going at the time when we made the decision to come here. So these are the current objectives of the genetic program, and they align directly with MVP, as Chris already talked about, but sort of develop a framework for informed decisions regarding alternative breeding strategies using genetics to assess the potential for genetic gain and trade-offs among economically important traits. And you asked about the traits, and we were going with the same traits that Chris was looking at. So for production, looking at what Chris has already shown on yield, basically. At least initially. And then the second one is evaluate and optimize mixed family breeding strategies. And we worked with the MVP program to look at mixed family breeding strategies. And the last one is identify genetic markers to also improve that breeding program.
Doctor, can I ask you a really stupid question? I understand that you're breeding for production, but I think about hybridized roses, for example, versus the roses that came from my grandmother's garden. And in the hybridization, the smell got bred out of them. They look beautiful, but they don't smell so hot. And I'm curious where in this whole conversation is the taste piece, because ultimately these are consumed in high-quality Epicurean centers, and what do you do to maintain the integrity of our almost iconic West Coast oysters?
Good question, and Chris can maybe help me here, but so there's sort of two questions there. One is sort of hybrid, which is a genetic question, hybrids versus the way we're going about family, mixed, yeah. Maybe Chris can answer that. How we're doing the actual breeding strategies.
On the record, please. Well,
the other one's about taste, and actually maybe you can do that too. I mean, we sort of go with what the ARS, and I believe Chris as well, certainly goes out to the industry, our stakeholders in industry, and says, okay, what do you want to breed oysters? You know, what do you want out of the breeding program? And taste has not been, I think, at the top of the list. I think we don't really know how taste works in oysters. Maybe we do know something about smell in roses, but taste hasn't been.
And maybe that's a bad analogy. I don't know.
So this is Chris Langdon here. So oysters taste. There is an effect of genetics, because those of you who are connoisseurs know that Kumamoto oysters taste very different from Pacific oysters, that taste very different from native oysters. So there is a genetic component. But there's more, I think, of an environmental impact or influence on their taste. So I discovered a new word called the terroir. It's like terroir in wine. So terroir, it means that the flavor of the animal is dependent on the environment in which it's grown. And so now the oyster industry is becoming very clever in that they're identifying specific flavors and tastes of their oysters, and they're beginning to market them. As such, so the combination of genetics and and the environment and affects their taste.
Thank you.
Okay. So, as I said, MBP is the reason USDA is located here. Chris also mentioned that we've had a vacant geneticist position, so the I don't have that scientist, Mark Camara, who was here before, left in 2012, and that happened about the time of federal government cutbacks as well, sequester and things like that. So we have not replaced that geneticist scientist position for various reasons since 2012. So I'm sort of acting in that role. That budget is still come, you know, the budget, federal budget is still here for that, mostly because the industry and other stakeholders have gone back and argued for that. But it's been on sort of the, within the agency on the cut list since 2012. So that's sort of what's going on with the geneticist position.
So Dr. Dumbold, is there, I'm looking to, is there an opportunity to collaborate between the USDA and OSU on that geneticist's position? Talk. I'd like to know a little bit more about this.
Yeah. Okay. So, and we are doing that, collaborating with OSU. OSU is, you know, one of our stakeholders, of course.
Were there two at one time? Or were there two positions?
There were.
And now there is only one, and there is some overlap in how they're funded, or there is not? I'm looking for
two positions. Those projects. we've had the discussion in the agency whether we would combine them into one project, one big project. They've, for whatever reason, when they were initiated, because they were separate, they were kept as separate projects. But they're still funded the same way, and we sort of report to the same person. But they're and those still exist.
One filled and one unfilled.
Right.
Yes, Dr.
Yeah, so one's filled, one's unfilled. We've been having a lot of discussions with ARS. Okay, over that position. And the question they want to know is whether the state of Oregon is going to invest long-term in shellfish research and the MBP program. That, to a significant extent, and you're nodding your head, you've been involved in those discussions, will determine if and when they will fill that position.
I would just comment, that's crummy. They know that we cannot bind future legislators, and so if they put you in a catch-22, we're not going to fund you till the state of Oregon funds you, and we can only go biennium to biennium. I would hope two things would occur. One, that you would be able to show this legislation and this initiative, and that you would be able to call on the legislature to write letters, particularly the Coastal Caucus, of support for this program, but to hold you hostage for their funding based on what we do, I think is cowardly.
And we've explained that to them.
Not like that.
I didn't use the word cowardly to the agency, but they want to be strongly supportive. But their challenge is when Congress gave them the money for these positions, they weren't fully funded. They only got half from the federal government what they asked for. So they need, there's a codependence here with the OSU's breeding program, okay?
Then somebody needs to make us partners in that. That's the first time I've heard that. And that's a powerful argument to say that this much money leverages this much money. We've got to figure out, and I hope it's one of the outcomes of this group, is how we make those connections, because in the absence of that knowledge, we're just standing here leaving money on the table.
Well, that's why we're raising the issue to form this committee of those kind of partnerships and leveraging that's going on.
Don't wait for a committee. Pick up the phone.
That's our job.
I know.
Thank you.
I would say, though, that OSU has certainly gone, as you say, has already picked up that phone and certainly gone back to D.C. and done, you know.
Yeah.
I think even at the state level that's happened.
With our congressional delegation on this very issue and with ARS. So there are, we just probably haven't informed the
Coastal
Caucus.
But if we can get engaged in that conversation, it can be helpful. And this is the whole plethora of collaboration that we need to work through. Yeah, because if we're all pulling on the same oar as we did with dredging, this is how we get it done.
I agree.
So that's why we're all here. Thank you.
Okay. My next point here was just that as part of that, at least from my end, as sort of interim manager of that genetics project, we are trying to at least utilize the money that is still there. When we have a vacant position, some of that money goes away for that vacant position, but there's still money in that project. And we've established, we just this last year, working with Gil, established a and Chris established a specific cooperative agreement with OSU to forward the same cooperative research with initial goals of looking at really at ocean acidification. So again, you know, working with hiring a postdoc, putting a postdoc on board to sort of continue the, you know, help continue the project and work with MBP, Chris at MBP, and the hatchery, and look at inheritance breeding and for resistance to ocean acidification, some of the stuff that Chris was talking about. All right, and so the second project, this is mine. I know this one a little bit better than the genetics project, is developing methods to improve survival and maximize productivity and sustainability of Pacific shellfish aquaculture. So once it gets out into the estuary, once you get beyond the hatchery stage, is sort of my realm, and the current objectives. And within USDA, we write a five-year research plan. That's the way it works. And so this is my current, these are the objectives of my current five-year research plan. And the other objectives are the objectives that we had when we, before, actually, in 2012, we haven't redone them. When we get a new scientist on board, they'll create those new objectives. So mine are to quantify and model burrowing shrimp and ocean acidification. So this is the new aspect that I've tried to get into so that I'm sort of working.
Tell me about burrowing shrimp. I'm not familiar with the problem here.
I will get to that in just a minute.
Okay.
Sources of juvenile shellfish mortality that constrain oyster aquaculture production in West Coast estuaries. And my second one, and I'll get to this one too, is to quantify the influence of shellfish aquaculture practices. So here's where the BMP, best management practices part comes in your committee, on existing estuarine habitats, and quantify utilization of those habitats by fish and invertebrates at the scale of the whole estuary, so the whole estuary here. So I will go into burrowing shrimp. So, Shellfish Ecology Project, two species of burrowing shrimp, ghost shrimp and mud shrimp, burrow in the sediments in the estuary. They turn over that sediment. They have deep burrows, go down to a meter deep, and they burrow in that sediment and turn over the sand and cause shellfish to sink or under the surface of the mud and die. So here's some oyster spat, and they have these deep burrows that go down, and they are turning over that sediment, bioturbating, and they cause the shellfish to sink under the surface of the mud and die.
I want to look at the growers for a second. How big a problem is this? Because
where they are present, a huge problem.
Are they present in all estuaries?
Yeah.
How broadly dispersed is this?
I mean, I don't know acres-wise, but there's a lot of land that cannot be used because of shrimp.
That's good to hear. I haven't actually talked to these guys about the issue, the current issue in Oregon. We're taking data on it,
right.
On some of their, right next to some of their beds, but I haven't heard how bad that issue is currently in Oregon. The issue is huge in Washington. It's one of the reasons they established my ecologist position, really, is to do this. And also one of the reasons I was most qualified for that position, because I've studied it since I worked on my PhD at the University of Washington on this whole issue. So in Washington,
collaboration at the forefront, one of the questions I'm going to ask is, how do we connect your experience with your research to make sure that everybody's on the same page here? Is there an opportunity here?
Yeah, I don't know how much of the burrowing shrimp issue. That's the reason for asking about Oregon, sort of, and working in Oregon.
It is a big issue, but
you don't have tools.
I can see, you don't have this tool.
Okay, so this is the next.
Right now, we know what's currently going on in Washington with that whole issue. So
yeah,
I think.
And you,
almost it's a non-issue to even discuss.
Well, maybe. Maybe. So Washington, you know, they've sprayed a pesticide since the 60s up there, Carbaryl initially, 7, up through about 2013 or thereabouts, they applied Carbaryl. They agreed in 2002 to stop using the pesticide by 2012 or 13. I was involved in working on an alternative, which ended up being another pesticide, and going through environmental impact statements to do this. They went through several for the first one and lots of discussion and everything to apply a pesticide. they actually applied this pesticide in Oregon estuaries too for a while, and then it was banned in the mid 80s, in 1980s.
Sorry, when was it Oregon. Banned in Washington? The seven?
What's that? When was when it banned?
When did they stop using it?
They stopped using it in 2013 ish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And so then they went through a process that I was involved in, a bunch of research to look at alternatives, alternative ways to do it. And this is where maybe we're there, you know, there's some way forward here with our research. Basically couldn't find any alternatives. It's really difficult to kill these shrimp because they build this burrow that's really deep in the sediment. And so getting at them down really deep in the sediment is difficult. The pesticide has lots of environmental impacts, and they found out, this is what Sven was going to talk about here, this year, or last year, actually, when they finally, they ended up trying to permit another pesticide, which is much less toxic than the first pesticide, carbaryl, to other things in the environment, imidacloprid. But turns out last year they ran into sort of a buzzsaw. Because it got out in the foodie sort of world, and a bunch of non-science came out. Basically, so they got the permit to do it, went through all the environmental processes and everything, the state regulators and everything, agreed to permit it, and then it got out into the news world, and they the growers, it hit their markets basically, and a bunch of non-science sort of. They're spraying a neurotoxin, this is bad for you kind of thing, got into the world, and they agreed not to use it last year.
Twitter and Facebook basically came out.
I understand how that works.
Exactly.
Are there alternatives?
And so here's a burrow of one of those. This is a meter stick right here, so really long burrow. So my avenue has been really looking at the ecology of the shrimp, seeing if there's another way. Knowing something about the shrimp's ecology, is there another way to attack the shrimp? And my sort of emphasis has always been, well, at some point in their life, they have to be little teeny guys and only build little teeny burrows like this that don't go very deep, and maybe we can get at them with some other mechanical or some other mechanism. So that would be sort of my way forward. I haven't ever really got to doing that. We've been studying their ecology. In fact, I've been monitoring their biology in the estuaries in Willapa since I was working on my thesis in the 80s, and in Oregon estuaries in Tillamook and in Yaquina here. Another advantage of being at Hatfield is we've got a shrimp bed like a few hundred yards off the lab here, so I can go study them really easily right here. Is to try and attack these guys either, you know, mechanically. There's actually a call for proposals out right now from the Western Regional Aquaculture Center to, look at burn, you know, alternative ways of look at burn shrimp ecology and figure out ways to do that. So, yeah, and that's where, you know, Oregon, it would be very hard, I think, then, and the growers probably don't want to. I think that's what Sven was getting at, is they don't want to broach that issue because of what happened last year here and doing a chemical here. But if we could find other ways to manage them, they might be interested. So we have
to. They withdrew their permit, now they're reapplying for it.
That's right. I didn't get to that.
I understand.
A touchy subject up there.
Dr. Dobler, we have just a couple of minutes. We're going to have to get these other folks on the phone in a minute, but this is just fascinating. And
okay.
Again, if there's an opportunity through this process with this task force to create some sort of collaboration between industry and what you're doing, I mean, that's what we're all about. So.
Okay.
Senator, do you have any questions about this one?
No.
Okay. Yeah, so I've been monitoring their populations, and when these little guys recruit to the estuaries up and down the coast for both species of shrimp, in Grays Harbor, up in Washington, Willapa Bay in Washington, but in Tillamook Bay and Yaquina Bay here, a little bit in Coos Bay, since I got here in 2004 or 5. And, it differs from estuary to estuary, and so there's a bunch of ecology going on because these guys have little larvae that go out in the nearshore coastal ocean. So, again, being at OSU, there's lots of oceanographers doing lots of work off the coast here, and it's a really good collaboration working on the biology of these shrimp too and what's going on in the nearshore coastal ocean.
Great. Thank you.
So the other part of my work has to do with estuarine habitats and really how shellfish aquaculture like this, here's an oyster bed out there, behave in the estuary relative to a shrimp bed like this, and eelgrass, the other one of the big other issues here, which is a really valuable nursery habitat for lots of other fish and invertebrates out there. So studying, you know, how other organisms utilize those and how shellfish aquaculture interacts with in the estuary. Or shellfish aquaculture like that, like long lines. And so we had a project in Willapa, originally in Willapa, but now we've expanded to some of the estuaries in Oregon here as well, and actually collaborating with Steve's group with the ODF&W here and looking at habitat mapping in these estuaries. And our big thing is to see how shellfish aquaculture, so those maps we were talking about earlier, how those overlap with these other habitats in the estuary, and then how things utilize that. So we had a big project back in 2005 where we mapped all those habitats in Willapa Bay and went to a whole bunch of sites and mapped those habitats and then looked at how that overlaid with shellfish aquaculture at the whole estuarine landscape scale to see how those function. And then we could map that habitat. So Willapa has lots of shellfish aquaculture, and we could quantify it. So the numbers that we were talking about, only you guys for production, but for me it was, you know, how much is out there. So we interviewed all the growers and found out what they're actually using and then how they were using it and then how that impacted eelgrass, actually. So we've looked at the whole scale of an estuary, and we have plans to do that. We've had plans all along to do that. It's part of my project to do that in some Oregon estuaries as well.
So we haven't done any Oregon estuaries yet.
Steve's group has been doing the mapping. We haven't done the overlay of shellfish aquaculture. That's sort of what I'm hoping to do.
What's the time frame for that?
It's in my 5-year research plan right now, and we've got some money from Salt and Stahl Kennedy Funds from NOAA. Another researcher here is in, and then the Pacific Shellfish Institute up in Washington. So, and that is to do it in an Oregon estuary, and we haven't actually picked that estuary. It'll probably be, the easy one is Neatarts, so we started in Neatarts, but we may do Coos Bay as well, and we can discuss that, what estuary we do it in. And then looking at fish use at those estuaries. And then we're also doing it on Humboldt Bay. So, you know, that's another place where aquaculture is planned to expand anyhow, down in Humboldt. So it goes all the way from Washington to California.
And
so time frame is a couple years for Salt and Stahl Kennedy, 5 years for my plan overall here.
I guess one of the messages as we wrap this up, because we've got to get on the phone with these other folks in just a second, that the message, to be clear to you, as it is to Dr. Langdon, that when you need something, that you have a coastal caucus. It doesn't help you in Washington and California, but in Oregon, if we can write letters, if we can get a hold of our congressional delegation, we work with them very closely, and we're happy to. So do pick up the phone. Do let us know if there's ways that we can assist you in encouraging them to participate. Okay. I don't want that message lost.
Is there time for a quick question?
Yes.
So we haven't done anything in Oregon, but the research in Washington, do you say that shellfish aquaculture is detrimental to the eelgrass growth? Because I see that with Fish and Wildlife, difference to you.
We're hearing the opposite.
That is a very restrictive approach that they take on plant leases, that, you know, they're all about that shellfish aquaculture is detrimental to the eelgrass, and I see and I hear a lot from the industry that it's the opposite, that it's like it's a reef that promotes eelgrass growth and allowing aquaculture, eelgrass and shellfish aquaculture actually symbiotic and they help each other out.
Yeah, so I don't know what the short answer to that is. We've done, you know, a whole bunch of work at the small scale, which suggests that eelgrass production is definitely affected when you put shellfish out there. So at the one scale, if you put, you know, a bunch of oysters out there, they take up space. So that's the simple one. And you can't have an eelgrass blade where you have an oyster in that place. But there's all kinds of other things that go on. So cycle nutrients. They, in some estuaries, filter the water and can take out phytoplankton, which prevents light from getting to eelgrass, which really limits eelgrass growth. Our landscape scale study, where we finally then took it up to, and that's what I'm, you know, hoping to do in Oregon estuaries too, is we sort of know what happens at the process scale, although it differs potentially from estuary to estuary. But at the landscape scale in Willapa Bay, we just published a paper that suggests that overall that impact is pretty minimal. You know, at the scale of all of Willapa, which has thousands of acres, it was down to, you know, several acres of ground changing units. So, you know, and probably enhanced on some of those. But what you have to do is sort of what we did was ran models that suggest here's where, whether eelgrass would be there or not if oyster was there. If oysters were inside and outside of oyster ground, you know, would eelgrass be there in the oyster ground, and then what's the difference? I don't have those slides here. This is sort of a general presentation to talk about how we might collaborate.
Sure.
But
we're
yeah, that work should hopefully, that's a place to collaborate and continue to work, and that's how, where we hope to go with some Oregon estuaries as well.
Go ahead. Did you have a question, Claire?
I just want to make sure I connect with you, Brett, because I have students who've actually gathered information like that in Etards Bay, along where the sand dollar beds and the oyster beds and all the eelgrass beds all come together. And we have acres of data on the correlations of eelgrass with all the macroinvertebrates as well as all the burrowing clams and oysters. So we have a lot of data there from that particular area on the, right up against the spit.
And have you already connected with the folk at ODFNW on that?
I have not, no. Whiskey Shellfish Hatchery we have, but nowhere else.
Right. Yeah. So we've been working with Steve's shop there basically to get the maps.
With Tony D'Andrea. Yes.
With Tony.
Yes,
yeah,
I've talked to him. We've not shared that data across. We've shared other data, but not that data.
Our intent is to do that in Neatarts starting this year, really, looking at fish use mostly. Mobile fish and invertebrates is sort of my angle now. Not the benthos so much, although there'll be a little bit of that too. Yeah.
Great, thank you. We just got that one more.
Hello, and welcome to the Center Pathway, followed by the founder Hatchie.
Please finish up. Thank you. While he's dialing in one more question. Everybody good? It looks to me as though we have another opportunity for collaboration here with the work that Claire's doing. And again, if we can, I guess I don't want to leave untouched the idea that the phone is an important thing. Let us know if there are things that we can do to help encourage our congressional delegates to assist as well. We want this to be a very collaborative effort. We're calling now into Margaret Barrett and Peter Moore, Pacific Coast Shellfish Growers Association. And Svein, I think you're part of this, leading this charge as well for the next 45 minutes or so. And then we will have lunch.
Hey, this is Dan, who just joined us.
Hi, this is Margaret Barrett.
Hi, Margaret. So we'll get started in just a second. Is Peter there, too?
Yes, Dan. I just got on.
Okay, great. And Margaret, you have another time commitment shortly, I believe, at noon, right? So we could maybe start with you, and then you could potentially join back with us. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That's what I was going to say. The other one probably won't take very long, so I will pop off and then come back on.
Great.
Okay. Well, you guys are live, and then I'm going to hand it off.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning, Margaret and Peter. This is Caddy, and Senator Johnson is also here. Would it be helpful for you to have us do quick introductions, or are you okay if we just jump right in? I think you know who's been assigned to the task force. We do have a number of other interested parties in the room, but I'll take your lead on what you need.
I'm okay with you skipping on that. The only thing I'd ask is before someone speaks that they just say who they are.
Okay. All right, Peter, you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine with that, Caddy, but Margaret's recommendation is a good one. That'd be great.
Okay, and Svein is here to assist you in this conversation. This is a discussion of the needs of shellfish growers, and we have about 45 minutes now assigned to this conversation, so I'm just going to turn it over to the three of you to lead this conversation.
Okay. And Marty, do you have any introductory comments? Because then you're going to have to take off, but initial thoughts. Otherwise, we can roll right into it. So,
Peter, maybe I could give you a starting place, and that is you and Margaret are obviously very familiar with what's going on in Washington. Are there good things that we can pilfer from Washington that will help move us faster and farther down the road?
Well, I mean, and Margaret, chime in. I mean, what's interesting is the dynamics are really actually quite distinct, between Washington and Oregon. We have different dynamics at the federal regulatory level. We have different dynamics at the state level. There are aspects of the Washington Shellfish Initiative that certainly were taken up a number of years ago, and Margaret can briefly comment on that. But to the credit of both you and Patty, we at the same time are enjoying a piece of legislation right now that is pretty much ahead of the curve. We're going to be discussing briefly here sort of the fundamental things that are of immediate concern to the industry and the growers specifically. But one of the things that Washington does enjoy, and something that's one of the items on our hit list, is at the state regulatory side, you are dealing with some authorities up there that have just, and even at the federal side on the services, National Marine Fisheries specifically, we've got regulated agencies up there that understand the industry better than they do down here. And I think that is probably one of the biggest assets in Washington. It's a much bigger industry, and that's the key there. But Margaret, do you have any additional comments there?
Yeah, and I apologize. I was on mute earlier and talking to myself. But, I think that we just celebrated a relaunch of the Washington Shellfish Initiative on Friday. And it was a really impressive event, both celebrating the things that had been done since the initiative first occurred, we're starting to build the momentum for initiative back in 2011. We've had many accomplishments with the Blue Ribbon Panel on ocean acidification, working to better understand the permitting issues and process by which we're going through. Learning about how folks interact with shellfish and with their opportunities to get out to beaches and enjoy shellfish. And figuring out ways in which restoration can be better incorporated into the state's business. And so those are all great accomplishments. We're still looking at doing more. We actually, one of the other accomplishments I forgot was opening up about 2,400 acres of shellfish ground that had been closed. And through different efforts, been able to open those up. And that's a really big piece, not just for commercial harvest, but for recreational as well. And so we celebrated those, and we acknowledge that there's still more work to be done, and we have some phase two goals, which are along those same lines, but to further those efforts. And I think one of the most exciting things about what happened on Friday was the group that got together, all on the same sheet of music, all interested in where shellfish goes here forward. And these are things that I think Oregon could accept with open arms as well, in terms of we recognize that Oregon has had shellfish in its past. We know that this has been an important food source for generations, and we want it to continue in Oregon to be an important food source and recreation opportunity and opportunity for research and opportunity for the economies of the local community. So this commitment to a future that sustains shellfish is, I think, what I would love to see Oregon carry forward. And that means starting off somewhat slow and small, but being open to growing and including more people into that those activities. And that's what happened here in Washington. And I feel like nothing's stopping Oregon from making the same approach and even improving upon it, making it even better.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. Peter, do you have anything else to add to kind of the lay of the land in Washington and how we might be able to mirror some of it?
Well, most of, what I do in county primarily is all Oregon-based. So Margaret's definitely, her universe and her lens is going to be much more accurate on that front than mine. I deal primarily just with all that affects the industry down here. But I can't emphasize enough, Margaret had mentioned too that the permitting side, when I think of things that as far as the future growth of the industry down here or, and establishment and, as Margaret said, greater recognition at the state level, the effect of state agencies in that conversation, that is definitely something that I think, that's on our short list of things to be addressed by the task force. That was something, of course, we also discussed when you all were taking the oar on getting that bill through the legislature. So, but I think there are opportunities, and we'll discuss those. But this is an enterprise, excuse me, an industry where we cannot meet demand in the state of Oregon, and that's exports to the RIN, that's exports across the country, and then that's also shipping products across the country. I mean, we cannot meet demand. You talk to the more material growers in the state, and simply, demand outstrips supply exponentially. So.
Spain, do you have anything?
Patty, this is Mark. I'm curious, though, is there something specific that I can talk to make more of those connections? The fact that you guys have had a bill go through already makes you steps ahead of Washington, because we don't have a bill. We're talking about doing a letter this year and having legislators sign on to that letter. What we're seeing really is sort of an energy developing out of the governor's office and his cabinet agencies.
And we've been fortunate to have that support all along. I guess my question to you in the industry is, we have a half hour to have a discussion about this. We're going to have, three or four more meetings as we all educate ourselves with an eye towards this collaborative work that we want to do to provide support for this industry on the research side and on the production side. And I think at some point we're going to need to have very specific ideas as to what this organization can recommend in the next bill that will come in the next session to move this initiative forward. So I guess I'm going to look to Senator Johnson as well, but we're looking for things that are very specific that we can hang our hat on as we move this recommendation forward for a bill. And we have Gabriella in the room representing the governor's office, and we also have the Sea Grant Fellow, Cassina, who is now working out of the governor's office as well. So they're well represented here today, and I just wanted to make note of that.
I think one of the things that is not bill material, but it comes under the general heading of administration, and that is, Peter, the Coastal Caucus had one of the most frightening presentations that I have witnessed in my time in the legislature. And that was
last week,
and I think all of us shared the opinion it was a horrifying presentation. It was DEQ talking about how they're not going to write new rule, but they're going to reinterpret existing rule once the general permit for processors expired, and they're now going to impose all sorts of new standards based on species processed and based on body into which water is discharged. They have no real work plan. They have no sense of urgency. They have not included the industry. They're pretty vague about how they intend to go about doing this work. And I believe that it is nothing short of existential. And I don't know how much the processor world is aware of it. There was supposed to be a big meeting in Newport December the 30th. That was a cattle call for the industry to come and share with DEQ what their issues are. And in the next breath, DEQ says, they're too frightened to meet with us one-on-one, so we got to do this big cattle call. Competitors are not going to sit in a big room and talk about their specific issues. Compounding this problem is that we have a plant that is getting ready to rebuild in Warrenton that the legislature is involved in, and we've got a plant that the legislature just approved $400,000 for on Friday down in the southern part of the state. The northern plant in Warrenton went to DEQ and said, what are the standards that we need to build this plant to? A 1940s plant was being replaced by a 2016. And the answer was, we don't have those rules, so you just build the plant and we'll tell you whether or not you hit the mark. That's a $25 million investment, and 200 people are waiting to see if they can go back to work.
And Brookings is ready to
and
start.
And Brookings is ready to go. They'll be processing shrimp, and there are 50 to 75 people there, depending on seasonal. There is no sense of urgency. And I've just raised hell about this in every forum that I have had a mic in for the last 5 days. And so I think that Mr. Moore and others in the industry on the processing side of this need to figure out how to insinuate themselves into the conversation, because as I snarled at DEQ, this is queued up to do it to the industry, not with the industry. And I think there needs to be a clarion call from the processors as the state undertakes this effort to make sure that they are included at every turn, because this does not bode well for an industry that could easily be regulated out of business by mid-level bureaucrats in Salem. The mass has ended. You may go in peace.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Yes, Faye and I had a brief conversation about this recently. Mark Weiger actually brought this to my attention as well. This is classic. Well, this is classic. I don't say classic DEQ, but, well, we can all draw our own conclusions on that. So I think that all still goes into, you know, Senator McKeown, this goes back to sort of your individual items. But we do have that list of things which are that we consider currently primary import to the industry. And I could simply run through those.
Please do.
There are only four of them. And these are all generated in the greater context of the conversation we had with you all pushed the bill through. So I'd be happy to do that, and I'll just start with, does that sound good?
Yes, yeah. Please.
Okay, so the last one, I'm going to start with the last one, because the last one, of course, is, there are four, the last one is the importance of solidifying the role of ODA as the lead agency governing activities in the industry.
And that is?
ODA has exclusive jurisdiction over the regulation of shellfish for purposes of plat permitting. ODSW has a regulation over otherwise non-commercial shellfish species on the coast. And historically speaking, it's been a troubled relationship. I think it's been difficult for ODA. The other affected agencies don't know much about the industry. And I think, and Senator Johnson, you're familiar with this, back in 2012 when they went to go issue a 401 of under the Clean Water Act, a water quality certification for the nationwide permit 48. They came out with a draft denial, and of course I proceeded to rip into that and basically say these are all the reasons why your analysis doesn't make sense in the reports you guys are relying on. Actually don't say what you're pulling them out of saying in your report. And ultimately, to DEQ's credit, they took it out of the hands of the 401, traditional 401 third office, sent it to another department. Those guys actually talked to me. They talked to growers.
And Peter, Alex is here today, by the way. Alex is
here today, okay.
Yeah, so he heard you.
And Gabriella and Cassina and Margaret and I and Shane, we've been having these conversations. And again, and the governor's office actually has been, you know, while we're at it, I mean, it's been very good in supporting us in this process. So that's number one. And I think, Betsy, your comments about what DEQ is up to necessarily fits within that. My presumption, right, and I gave is DEQ and PAL, what they're proposing to do may or may not affect the shellfish industry, much less many other processors throughout the state because they come in all shapes and sizes. Second thing, just starting at the top, would be, and this is something we discussed during the legislation, was the closure issue. When there is a closure of growers' ability to harvest, that window gets shut for a period of time. It's all based on water quality. Those water quality conditions typically come from up basin, inland, and so these are not water quality conditions created by the industry itself. As you all know, the shellfish industry is basically, they are the ones most concerned about water quality because whenever water quality goes south, they're the first ones to get hit. The people who produce those water quality issues, obviously there's really no blowback on them, but at the end of the day, we're the guys that are at the bottom of the drain, and so the industry gets hit with that. The objective there would be to come up with the resources to go and say, okay, we need a little more man-woman power in the field, or at least we need ability to design some protocols with the growers between, say, Alex and the growers, to allow for more sampling so we can shut these closure windows sooner than later. Yaquina Bay, for example, as a matter of course, it's 5 days when there's chances where those closures should only be available for two. Fane can comment on Tillamook, but, you know, he's losing days every month when there are closures, and there's nothing he can do about it, even though conditions more likely than not have totally changed with it well before the period of time that the thing opens up again.
Hey, Peter.
So the day that these guys are shut down is the day that stuff's not going out the door and into the marketplace.
Peter, just one second. Peter Spain wants to make a comment. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Oh, you can't hear me. That's true. Okay. Is this a good spot to have Alex give a real quick on the Tillamook sampling? I know.
Peter, would you prefer to continue with your remarks, or do you mind if we have comments made about what's happening with the pilot in Tillamook right now?
I think that'd be good. I think, you know, I'm just trying to go quick here because I know we don't have much time. So yeah, I think
why don't you finish up your four points, and then we'll ask Alex to comment. How's that?
Okay. The second one was certification of additional grounds. The areas that currently are probably primary in the industry are Alsea Bay and other parts of Tillamook, and Spain can comment on that further. But we think there are opportunities where, if supported, ODA could go out. I know Alex is, and I want to speak for Alex, but it's my understanding he's been compiling some data on areas that were previously certified and potentially could be certified again, as well as maybe certified new ground for expansion of the industry. The third point is one we've been investigating, and Shane has even had some conversations with ODFW to some degree, and that is evaluating and confirming the opportunity to commercially harvest additional species beyond just oysters. So there's some interest in Coos Bay for the commercial harvest of clams. That would also occur, though, a couple different issues there, but we can discuss those later. But there's closure issues down there, as well as the ability to allow for clam transport and import-export issues. And then the last and fourth one was the one we already discussed involving ODA, the lead agency, and then, you know, as that dovetailed with Senator Johnson's comments about DEQ.
Great, thank you.
I missed one of them. We got ODA, we've got closure issues, certification of additional grounds.
And evaluate additional species.
Oh, okay.
And then additional
the clams.
That's we talked about at our initial meeting about the Manila clam and not being able to farm it in Oregon.
And I have refresh my memory. Is that statutory?
I actually have enough that I can go over that.
Okay, let's go ahead and touch, and Alex, if you want to touch on the pilot in Tillamook on the water quality testing, and then Svein, go ahead and the Manila clam update. Okay.
All right, so the Tillamook pilot project, I only made 15 copies, but this is just a quick summary of...
And for those of you, while we're passing this around, may not be aware, in the bill that we passed in the last session, we provided some funding to do a pilot program in Tillamook Bay to put enough staff there to test more regularly to see if openings could occur more quickly. So that's what this is about. And it was a couple $100,000, Senator, if I remember correctly.
I don't remember.
Something like that.
$175,000.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the table I'm sending out is just kind of what we've got done so far. Looks like we've gone out five times. We've got one set of results still pending. In the table, you'll see the date that we went out, and then OSI 1, 2, 3, and 4, those are the trial stations. And Svein also made up a map of where they're located in the bay. And so quickly, just the idea was that we create these stations with the view that maybe we can create a new management area that's less restrictive, that wouldn't get closed quite as frequently, so the industry could harvest more. And so at the bottom of the page, I've just got a kind of a key there. The current management plan has the lower bay closing when the Wilson River is at 7 feet. So what we try to do is go out there when the Wilson River was a little bit above 7 feet and then see what the water quality was like there, and then kind of test that against what the FDA water quality standards are, which, the values are 100 fecal coliforms per 100 grams, and the standard is 43. So you'll see that the first run, the run that we did on 11-2 when we went out with, was pretty bad. I will say that that is was kind of like the first big storm of the winter. So, you know, what we call a first flush, we get a lot of pollutants end up in the bay that first storm. So it's kind of not surprising we had some pretty horrendous numbers there. But as you'll see, that the further along into the winter we got, you know, we were starting to get some pretty decent numbers there. Even the one that we collected on 12-14, there's some high numbers, but if you look on the right, that river peak, that was a significant flood event in Tillamook. There were 20.5 feet. So... you know, I think these numbers, we got a lot more sampling that we can get done this winter, but I think what we're seeing is encouraging as far as being able to maybe create this new area that we would originally talked about doing.
This is where you might be able to enlist some of the students who are on the ground there looking for real-life science experience and have a teacher willing to take them out to do this, so you get free labor with all those students.
He gets that from industry.
Already, so you can easily join up with you, Alex. Uh-huh. They've actually listened to you present this at the watershed councils.
Yeah, I've been there once before, so yeah, I'd be happy to talk about this. And the Tillamook Bay Estuaries Partnership does a lot of sampling of the tributaries coming into Tillamook, and we kind of compare notes as far as when we go out in the bay, seeing what they've got from the tributaries to maybe trying to pinpoint maybe where it's coming from. So if we get some high levels in the bay and they're finding that the numbers in you know, the Wilson River on a particular day were really high, then maybe there's some pollution issues up that in that catchment area. So anyway, that's kind of where we're at. With the sampling, so we've done a few of these now, and we target whenever the river goes up a little bit above that 7 foot point, then we go out there and we're going to collect some more samples. So that's what we've got so far.
So Alex, we funded this pilot program, and I'm curious, you know, when we reach the end of the day here in September, we need a recommendation to move forward. So I think what I'd like to glean from this is, of course, was the pilot successful? Are there changes that we could possibly make? How do we make those? Are there other estuaries that we need to do pilots in as we move forward? Is this information that's going to move us into a new realm of water quality testing. Where do we go from here with this limited pilot that we're doing? What's next? What do you need?
Right. So, I mean, anytime we do these additional samples and closure, that's kind of above and beyond what we have to do for the program to begin with. So these are not official samples because they were taken during a closure. So, you know, the commercial shellfish program is underfunded to do the samples that count. So I guess if we wanted to do more of these pilot projects, then, you know, it would require additional funds to do it. We got that money in this bill to do this. So I think if this is, you know, turns out to be successful and it has an outcome that benefits the industry, then obviously we can look at maybe some opportunities in some of the other bays where, you know, like we talked about at the beginning, you know, our closure management is kind of a blunt tool. I mean, we do the best with what we have, but if we want to refine it more, it takes a lot more samples that, like I said, are above and beyond what we have to do. It's more.
So I guess what I'm getting at is right now we have a blunt instrument that says you close for so many days. So what I don't understand as a layperson, if it's a five-day closure and you can go out and sample and show that the levels are down, can you open? Or do we need some regulatory change that says the five-day is not the rule, that we're going to change the rule and say it actually is based on the science of the testing and not on the blunt instrument? I don't understand that.
The question I think is, based off of the samples that we take here, could you change the closure criteria for that section of Lower Bay based on these samples? And if, or would we have to do?
And Peter, we're looking at Mr. Barcellas from the Department of Ag here. What has to change to impact the industry in a positive way regarding this issue?
Yeah, and because this is such a limited look at this, also we can't make decisions on that limited view yet. But there's always the potential of making changes in the future with these kinds of studies. The more information we have, the more science we have behind us, the better it is to make these proposals that allow us to change the scope of what we're looking at when it comes to closures and other aspects. And of course, we have to deal with our federal partners also on this. And it's not easy to change that philosophy sometimes also, but science helps in every one of these cases to give us more information, a bigger oomph in trying to present to them a way to make some changes that are more beneficial for this process, for the industry as well.
I guess, well, how many, for the Bay plans to change for Tillamook to either create another area or lessen, or I guess raise the river level for that lower section of the bay, how many of these samples do we need to have over what time frame?
Given any discussion on that beforehand, before the study was
And please, Peter's on the phone. I don't know. Peter, can you hear? I'm going to ask everybody to try and speak up so you can capture this conversation as well.
Yeah, that was a little tough to catch that, Caddy. So, you know, I can either follow up with Frank or but I heard Alex's comments, but so.
I think at the end of the day, you know, we funded a pilot. We need to understand what the pilot does. And as we move the initiative forward, if we're going to move this bar, what else do we need? What's next?
Yeah, for ODA to be comfortable to change the Bay plan and for it to pass muster with FDA, does, if we do 15 samples this winter and 15 samples next winter, is that the time frame? Is that enough samples? What's our...
Well, to create a new, if you were to create a new growing area in a separate bay, you would need 30 water samples collected over at least a year's period of time. In this case, since it's an existing bay, we're just modifying a management of it. I think if you can demonstrate you collected enough samples, and I don't think there's anything in rule that actually says how many it would have to be, if we feel confident that we have a body of evidence that says, you know, this is going to be a good management approach, then we could make that case with the FDA, and then our water quality reports, if that continues to demonstrate that, they'll be satisfied.
And the Department
that.
Of Ag.
Yeah.
Of course, I think Dr. Sylvia had a comment. Did you have a question or a comment?
No, a question about you guys are using the phrase science-based approach. So what do you mean by science-based? For example,
do you see developing predictive models for these bays? So is it a question of just doing a lot of sampling every day in every place, which is very expensive, or is it understanding the dynamics of that bay and the things that could influence water quality based on science, and then be able to use predictive models to determine whether you have opening or closures, and your level of confidence in that kind of approach?
Yeah. Basically, that's the true science that we're talking about. That's not necessarily the science that we hear sometimes from our partners on the federal side with FDA. They're looking at data points. They want data points to begin with for their review of this, and the 30 is pretty basic across the realm for FDA when you come to 30 basic data points. That doesn't mean that it's science. That doesn't mean that it's good science sometimes, but it does help us in starting this conversation with them. But the overall aspect that you're talking about is the better method that we would want to look at. We want to look at how this impacts each of these individual areas by themselves, and that's the more science base that we would have. This project, this whole pilot, is something that we would certainly encourage more of this activity to be going on with as you look at it as partners with us in academia, and as we look more with our partners on FDA, how are we going to present this in such a manner that we can get these scopes changed and things that will happen that affect the industry in less of a harmful way, where we can make decisions quicker and we can look at actually data coming down the line instead of always looking at how our samples are telling us what's out there in fecal coliform levels or not.
Yeah. And so, I mean, in a way, we already do a predictive model. We don't close a bay when we get a certain water quality. We use certain predictors as a proxy for the water quality. So in this case, in the Tillamook Bay, we have two, which is the Wilson River height, and we also have a rainfall level. So in this particular area of the bay is managed on the river height. We know from our body of water sampling over the decades that when the Wilson River gets to 7 feet, some of those stations in the bay are not going to meet water quality once it gets above that. Mm-hmm. And so that's our predictor. So every day of the year, we're checking river gauge height, and once that river gets above 7 feet, then we close the bay. So what we're doing in this example in the pilot project is to say, maybe some of the areas of the bay don't need to be closed when the river gets to 7 feet. And so we're going to look for a less restrictive management approach in part of the bay. And so when Wilson River goes above 7 feet, then we're going out and testing that theory to see maybe, you know, if the water quality.
I want to make sure, I want to do another time check. We have 10 minutes left. I think that Mr. Moore is time sensitive, and I know Margaret was. I don't know. Margaret, are you back on? She's not. Okay, but Peter, I want to make sure you have your full component of time. We have 10 more minutes, so is there anything else from the association perspective that you would like to enlighten us with before your time is up?
I think that, thank you, Kelly. The four main things, I mean, you know, those that are listed, that's really where, in talking with the growers, that's really where folks thought that was, those are the most pressing concerns. I think the one that is probably the least defined, of course, the other ones are all pretty applied. The one involving the agencies, and then obviously with Betsy's comment about, DEQ sort of taking a blanket rush on processor discharge, obviously that is a major, major concern for the industry. And again, I think that is case in point of what is affecting the industry relative to compliance issues, and the fact that a lot of these state agencies don't understand the industry and come in with a presumption of you did something wrong rather than understanding what actually has been going on for the last 80 to 90 years.
And Peter, a corollary to that as well, I think, is this growing body of mythology that is developing on the coast, where we attribute certain sins to certain industries without a lot of what I'm going to say is good science. Let me be more specific, that any commercial logging results in a degradation of water quality. And there, it, in my perception, if that gets said enough, it becomes true. And I think that in addition to educating agencies, that some kind of a public acknowledgement that there's not a direct correlation between water quality and some commercial activities. I'm not saying that that's a blanket statement, but there's a lot of mythology out there.
Right, and Betsy, one of the more recent examples we'll have, just as, you know, there was a, you know, eelgrass dies off at the end of every early fall, late summer, and I know that we had some growing operations. Faye and I, in particular, were dealing with some things, and Steve Rummel was terrific in being sort of a guidance opportunity for ODFW, but people out there in the community were complaining about, oh, well, you know, it's these mechanical harvests that are just chopping all this eelgrass, and we got eelgrass clogging up the estuaries, and we can't fish, and da 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 da. And none of these people had any idea that mats and mats and mats of eelgrass on an annual cycle die off, and then, of course, they float to the surface. But still, that took us time, and it took us, you know, about a month and a half to 2 months to calm people down. And you know, I was even getting panic calls from ODA under those scenarios as well. They were, to ODA's credit, they were telling me this is going on, and that's how I learned about it. But all the same, you know, I think your case, your point is well taken about the public, and that education component has to reach out to the public as well as those from other agencies in the field.
Peter, I think you'll be gratified to know that on many of your issues, prior to you joining the phone call, we've already talked about them and have identified them. So, absent your input, we stumbled onto a few of your points by ourselves.
Oh, great. Perfect.
All right, yep.
So, Patty, to answer your question, I mean, that was my main concern coming in here, is to give you guys some discrete things that we think need to be attended to. That are important to the growers. And we recognize that you guys need that type of information, and so we want to try to make these things that could be readily identified by you and understood by you. So.
All right.
And, Peter, how do you represent yourself? You're on the agenda as attorney. I think that's is not completely the proper characterization of your advocacy on behalf of the Growers Association. What role are you playing there?
Well, I represent, I'm Oregon counsel for the industry association. And then, of course, I also assist individual growers when they have issues as well. But primarily, I am here speaking on behalf of the PCSGA members and the PCSGA in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other last questions for Peter before we turn him loose? Seeing none, Peter, thank you so much, and I don't know if you and Margaret must be in different places, but we will thank her from afar for her participation early on. This is an ongoing process.
She is based out of Olympia.
We will have three or four more meetings, and we'll certainly keep you in the loop as to the timing of those, and look forward to tapping you in the future.
Well, it sounds like we probably have a conversation coming up in the immediate term also about certain processing discharge issues. So, you know, we'll certainly follow up on that. But thank you both, senators, for weighing in on this, and thank you for pushing the bill through. Like Margaret said, you know, Washington has done amazing things up there. However, they also don't have actual legislation, and kudos to you guys for 2015.
And in the spirit of full disclosure, Peter, you are addressing me way above my pay grade. I'm a representative, not a senator.
Peter,
I just realized that. So, but you know, take it while it's there. Why not? Thank you very much to both of you, and thank you obviously for all you who are in attendance there. And Gabrielle and Justine, I'm sure we'll be in touch anyway.
Peter, before you ring off, I would appreciate it, this is Betsy speaking, if you would visit with Rod Moore about this DEQ issue, and I will keep you and him in the loop as I watch it unfold.
Okay, Rod Moore, DEQ, okay.
No, no, no. You call me. Call me. Call me.
Call the senator first.
Yes, I will call her first, of course.
All right.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, the phone. The one with the phone. Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. We are tenuously hanging on to a schedule here. And I want to give you a five-minute break. The lunch is served at 12:30. I want to thank the Hatfield Marine Science Center for providing lunch for us all today. So whoever is responsible for that, please thank you for providing us with lunch. Take a break. Grab your lunch. Come back in. And then we will begin again. Make this official. Thank you.
Yeah, it's intimidating. So I'm a PhD student in Dr. George Walbasser lab in OSU, and he's very sorry that he couldn't make it today. So I'm here on his behalf, I just thank the opportunity for being here. It's quite great for a student. The presentation I'm going to give, it's kind of a travel among the life stages of an oyster and how they're impacted by ocean acidification, and all the research projects that my lab has been involved in the past and is involved in the future, trying to understand the impacts and help the industry as much as we can to mitigate those impacts. I want to start before with the results of a survey that a former grad student in our lab, Becky Mabordi, did as part of her master's thesis. Becky now is the project and outreach director at PCSEA. And she did this in 2013. And what she found was that the US West Coast shellfish industry reported that 80% of them thought that ocean acidification had negative consequences for people today, which contrasts to only 20% of the general U.S. public thinking that. Another thing that she found was that over half of the industry had reported already experiencing negative impacts for OA, and a third of them were not sure, which speaks to the need of further research, further outreach from us to help the industry define needs and threats to their industry. On a positive note, though, 5 out of 6 respondents thought that the effects could either be mitigated or at least were not sure, which opens the door for mitigation to be effective. And also 90% of the respondents thought that partnerships with university were not only beneficial and useful, but also a high priority for the industry to be able to adapt. So how this ocean acidification OA problem become such a concern for the industry. Before we jump into that, I would like to give a very quick introduction to what OA is. This is the only graph I'm going to be showing, so just bear with me, just one. As CO2 increases in the atmosphere, which you can show there in red, increasing over time, it also gets dissolved in the ocean, which makes that dissolved carbon dioxide in the ocean goes up to, which is shown in green. Parallel to those increases, pH of the ocean goes down. pH is a measure of acidity, and concurrent to that decrease, another parameter that we call saturation state also goes down. And I don't want to get into the details, but saturation state can be defined as a measure of how corrosive the water is for calcium carbonate. And calcium carbonate is the material that bivalves use to make their shells. And it's also important to know that waters do not have to become fully acidic, which is a pH below 7, for them to already be very corrosive for the shells of the bivalves. But this is all very general and global, and what we're interested here is what that means for Oregon. So, Oregon. Oregon is what we call an ocean acidification hotspot. And what that means is that natural processes like upwelling further increase the concentration of dissolved CO2, which then in turn really means that we're experiencing OA at a faster rate than other regions in the world, We are a little bit of a canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world. But also what this means is that in the coastal ocean, carbonate chemistry or dissolved CO2 is very variable over the course of days, weeks, seasons, even years. But even a shifting baseline of this background dissolved CO2 increasing ends up resulting in extreme negative events, or what you can call OA storms, becoming more frequent, more intense, and lasting longer. So the flip side of that is that the windows of good conditions of carbonate chemistry that is good for shellfish are becoming shorter and less frequent. And what that means for shellfish is that we already know that about 80% of the shellfish species that has been studied to date, which we still have a lot to go, but 80% of the ones that we already know show negative impacts. And if the windows of good chemistry are getting shorter, that's really not good news for the bivalves. And before we get into the research, I wanted to spend just 1 minute discussing what the life of an oyster really looks like. And it, you can see there in the schematic that is complex. They start as eggs and sperm release into the water. They get fertilized. They become larvae, spend a variable amount of time as larvae in the water. Then they find the shell. They settle, undergo metamorphosis, and they grow into adults, and the whole cycle starts again. What we know already through research is that they're not equally vulnerable at all stages during their life. So there's what we call sensitivity bottlenecks, where specific times during their life, they're more vulnerable to the same carbonate chemistry conditions. And we've identified a few of these, and over the course of this presentation, I'm going to be threading all the projects that my lab has been involved in relating to different stages of the life of the oyster. All right, so let's go in. This first project was a highly collaborative project at Dr. Landon's lab here. Matt Gray were deeply involved. Other partners in OSU were also. And what we were interested in here was to understand why the larvae, when they're very early larvae, very young larvae, only 2 days old larvae, are so sensitive to OA and why. And what we found was that this early larval stage, the growth metrics, survival and growth, were related to saturation state, that variable that we talked about before. And the reason we think is because they have to put on so much shell in so little time that this is kind of a race of sorts. Here in this panel, these are photographs of larvae, Pacific oyster larvae. By 18 hours post-fertilization, they have no shell. 6 hours later, then 90% of their body weight is shell. This is an immense amount of shell that they have to build really quickly. These are tiny animals. They're like about the diameter of your hair. But still, they have to put an immense amount of shell for relative to their body size. And they can't feed at this stage, so they're relying only on the energy that they have in the egg. And therefore, any impact or any another stress in this time of their life just pushes them a little bit over the edge. So the link to saturation state in particular is very important because the thresholds that become negative impacts will be crossed sooner for this parameter than others. So if we think about CO2 or pH in this particular stage of this particular species, they will be impacted earlier because saturation state will change faster. We did this in native and non-native species, and we found that the non-native mussels and the native mussels responded equally, so they are both very sensitive, the same as the non-native oyster, the Pacific oyster. But the surprise came when we studied, Matt Gray in particular, studied native oysters, and we found that at this stage they're not very sensitive. So this is a hopeful story here that the native oysters in this stage might be better.
When you say native?
I'm talking Olympia.
Yeah.
So the outcomes for the industry on this particular project were varied, but it included better strategies to buffer the water within the hatcheries, the change of focus a little bit back into this very early stage, but the hatcheries had already been thinking about. Yeah.
Does this affect clams the same way it does oysters?
We don't know. We haven't done the experiments in clams. We could have some educated guesses based on their life strategy, but we haven't done the experiments, and I want to be very clear about that.
Thank you.
Right. I think what we're seeing in our company's hatcheries, we don't have the issues with clams that we do with oysters.
Right.
Nobody's actually studied it, but I think nobody's mentioning it, so maybe it's not as big of an issue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have had students who've looked at clams versus oysters. Oysters are easy to measure. Clams and the same thing, and they were butter clams, larva. They did not show almost any response like this, because maybe because they put down shells so slowly compared to oysters.
Yeah, which is another reason why we think, at least in the experiments we run, that native oysters are more resilient, and it's related to how fast they have to build their shell. There's another difference with the native oysters. The larvae are brooded inside the females for a while, but in the experiments we run, we remove that, and still they perform better, much better. Yeah.
I want to just raise that point I talked about when we met before, that one clam, the razor clam, does show very fast growth in this post-larval period, and may be one that should be a focus for some future research. Very important commercially and recreationally. It has these susceptibilities by fast growth, and yet we don't have research on it yet. So
right. Thank you. Sure. We need more funding for that, though. And another outcome for the industry is that we started to think a little bit more about these carryover effects, where larvae are impacted negatively on these first 2 days all of their life, and then the effects manifest later, not always right away. All right, so second project, we instead focus on the entire larval history. This is a project that I was very involved with, and we did a lot of the experimental work in the Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery, so very collaborative with the industry. The objective here was to know if we could get at a point where we could predict mortality or survival based on the exposure to different regimes of carbonic chemistry and how well we could test in a rigorous way that buffering actually worked for the hatchery, which we already knew it did. So the findings on this project was that even just buffering the first 2 days makes a huge difference, even if after that the larvae are not buffered anymore, which again comes back to the idea of these first 2 days being extremely important to mitigate the effects of OA. Then we also observed the delayed effects that I was mentioning, and then we finally were able to produce a metric, which we call OASIS, Ocean Acidification Stress Index for Shellfish, that can actually predict survival based on the history of carbonic chemistry that the larvae have experienced. So the outcomes from this project to the industry were basically confirm what they already knew about strategies for buffering, refine them a little more. The industry survey that I shared in the beginning was also part of this project. And then the possible future outcomes from this project would be maybe using this metric that we created, we can refine models for natural populations like Chris and Brad were talking about, Willapa Bay and other bays. And then maybe even hint cast recruitment failures, the recruitment failures that we've seen in the natural environment, maybe we can trace them back to carbonic chemistry problems. This project just started. In this case, it's focusing on the very late stages of the larval life, right before they metamorphose. Whiskey Creek has been experiencing some problems with these later stage, later season problems with mortality, and they don't seem to be connected to buffering, so they may not be such ocean acidification related. But this project just got funded by the USDA to start doing experiments within the hatchery, look at other chemistry problems that they might be there, and then potentially improve the production of the hatchery if we can figure out what's happening. Part of this project would be heavy data mining hatchery records, not only in Whiskey Creek, but in other hatcheries. I believe Taylor's is involved in this too, where we will look back at all the records they have and try to see if we can see a pattern with things that we haven't thought about yet. All right, this project was funded by NOAA. It still just started, actually. In this case, we're focusing on juveniles, so these are oysters that have already metamorphosed. They're attached to shell, and they're just starting to grow. And the aim of the project was to provide biological monitoring tools. So we have a very well-established already protocols to monitor the chemistry of the carbonate chemistry problem, but we're still in the early stages to think about protocols as a community that can trace back to how the animals are doing. So the story behind this project is to produce this kind of prototype of a loop that you see there that's outfitted with a special light that allows the growers to see how much fat it's in the oysters and if the oysters are happy and growing fast or not. The main goal here would be to in the end create a database of oysters from a lot of different places that the industry can trace by themselves and be provided with these tools, and we can get the data and see if we start to see some patterns there. And there's already interest in this project from the French shellfish industry, so this could potentially be an international collaboration too. This other project, another student in our lab, Stephanie Smith, has been primarily involved in. This also deals with this stage of early juvenile larvae. And what she was interested in with a theme that has actually come up a few times already in the room about seagrass improving or not oyster production. And what she did was first she developed a low-cost CO2 sensor for about under 2K, which it's a lot cheaper than usual. And allows us to deploy in much more places and get a better handle of what the chemistry really does in the bay. This happened in Nitard's Bay. And what she found was that native seagrasses, which is important, native seagrasses do improve or seem to at least improve significantly the growth of the planted oysters, but non-native grasses do not. We're still on the broad. Sorry.
I have a keen interest in invasive species. When you say non-native seagrasses, to what are you referring?
There's Japonica, and the other one is Marina. So I believe Japonica is the non-native, and Marina is the native. Sostera, both. So there are two species of eelgrass only in Nitard's Bay.
And how big of an issue is the proliferation of the non-native?
It's extensive. So it's throughout Coos Bay, throughout in Tillamook Bay, yeah. Nitard's.
These are identified as invasive?
Yes.
Yeah. And they're very easy to tell apart, too.
What is being done to control that?
Well, there's
I don't know.
Washington.
Is this another conversation for another day?
I can give you a quick. In Washington, there is an actual pesticide program in controlling it.
Okay.
Herbicide, sorry.
I believe Oregon does not have a pesticide.
Industry is significant, gentlemen. How significant is the impact on the industry of this non-native grass?
I think in Washington, and I think it ties into the clam conversation, I think it smothers clam beds more so than oysters.
Okay. So this is not a significant conversation for us.
No.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, of course. Well, and it seems like we're still going through the analysis of these data. These were just collected this past summer. But it seems like the good times, so the times where CO2 is low, are better in the plots that include native seagrass compared to the bare sediment or non-native seagrass. So the outcomes for the industry might be a potential habitat level mitigation strategy here where you can plant the oysters close to the native seagrass bed and improve their survival. Also, just the value in itself of preserving native seagrasses from a lot of different reasons. And then also this development of a low-cost monitoring tool that can now be replicated and used in places where maybe otherwise funding would prohibit monitoring.
Let me just stop and ask you a question. Your low-cost tool for monitoring, would that speak to the kind of initiative that's being undertaken in Tillamook where you need rapid samples that would affect a closure, and these were portable and low cost? Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
That would be something. This is a different mechanism completely from what we're looking at for fecal coliforms, though. But, yes, more science like that does help us, more ways to interpret the results that we have, a quicker response, but not so much in what we've talked about earlier today.
Okay, thanks.
Of course.
I have a question, though. If we already have people out doing this extra level of sampling, is there a way to collaborate and grab samples that can go benefit this research as well? I mean, can we utilize the quote boots on the ground in a different way to make sure that everybody's getting what they need, or is this not workable?
From my perspective, more data is always better.
Yes, sir.
We're talking the issue in Tillamook is fecal coliform, and here they're measuring percent CO2, so there are different parameters are being measured. So,
but you're grabbing water.
They probably are not grabbing water. It's probably a live, active measure as opposed to taking a water sample.
Okay. So they're apples and oranges. Okay, thank you.
So I just want to point there that we do have discrete sample collection, primarily through Dr. Burkhale's lab that analyzes a lot of the sample that the industry take, different growers, different hatcheries send the samples to us. This new device was a portable device that you could leave there and would stay there for months at a time, and we continually recorded data. All right, so this project also just started. I think this is a very interesting new research path. It's also focusing on this young juvenile stage, and what it's trying to do is a completely different approach. Instead of trying to measure the chemistry with sensors or water collection, what it's doing is using a proxy, which is an elemental ratio of uranium versus calcium in the shells, as a proxy to know what was the history of the pH that those shells saw or experienced during their life. So this project is just started, and it's still on the work plan stage. It's calibrating this ratio to monitoring data. But the goal in this project is to collect shells and be able to reconstruct this shell experience this. Therefore, it's a good or bad place to plant, or can we do better planting? Because it's not so much a problem here, but sometimes shell resources are limited. So if you can optimize where those shells go to increase settlement and recruitment to your populations, you're basically improving the results.
My question is, I appreciate this, and I think it would be a wonderful tool to look back over history for certain information. But my experience at Whiskey Creek was that the acidification hit that hatchery so fast that they went from literally billions of larvae in production to zero in a matter of weeks, if not a shorter period of time. Contrast the kind of long-range study that you're doing here versus the triage that you need to save an industry. Mm-hmm. I credit OSU for saving Whiskey Creek. Their response was remarkable. They sent down researchers right out of central casting. Send me an oceanographer PhD, and there he was. It was extraordinary, and they were then able to scale and do all sorts of other things. But contrast that long-range study versus the short-range triage.
Sure. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. This is a different life stage. So this is where the oysters are already set on a shell, and they're on their way to become adults over time. What the problem was at the hatchery was the larval stage, which lasts only 2 or 3 weeks. So in that stage, it's true that a long-range study will not really help. You need a quick response. What I believe, and this is, do not quote me on this, I'm just personally sharing my view, what I think is in the hatcheries, we've already figured out a way that they can buffer their larvae and get back into business. And like I mentioned, there's another project that is looking at later stages survival problems that they're having that do not seem to be linked to ocean acidification, but we don't know yet. So the first line of defense, I think, for the industry and for us as a researchers is to make sure that the hatcheries do produce, because if they don't produce, the whole industry falls. But once that is at least somewhat covered and we're making progress towards even refining it more, we need to start getting into these other life stages where we don't have that much data, we don't have that much research, to make sure that we continue to improve. Because I do want to say one thing. We've improved the production of the hatcheries, but ocean acidification in this coast is not going to get better for a long time. And we're getting towards worse and worse. That's just the natural environment. So it's important to keep working on the hatcheries to make sure that they don't go out of business. But at some point, these other life stages that so far haven't really shown the level of problems that the hatcheries have will. And if we know by then what are the steps that we should take, we'll probably be better ready to help the industry then.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, like I said, this project aims to kind of reconstruct where the shells live or experience over the course of their life, so we can spot better places in terms of carbonate chemistry only that may shelter a little bit the oysters. And just to wrap up, this is another project. It's primarily based out of the East Coast. We've tried to get funding to do these kind of studies here, but so far we've been a little unsuccessful. This is a completely different scope. It's not looking at individuals. It's looking at aggregation, so oyster reefs and oyster beds as ecosystems as a whole. And what it's trying to study is there feedbacks within these aggregations that make them better suited for oysters. Should we move towards a kind of planting scheme where instead of having very spread out beds or flats, we concentrate them because that way they get shielded a little bit from the carbonate chemistry. And I'd be happy to talk more about this project, but since it's not based out of Oregon, I don't want to take your time. All right, so that's it.
Thank you so much. That was a lot of information in a very brief period of time.
I know. My boss really
questions.
Insisted.
David, anyone have questions?
Swain? Mine was different, but did you want to go through the clam issue?
You know, I don't think we will today. If it's not germane to something that we need to jump on really quickly, I think for right now, since we're a little time constrained, we could leave that for another day.
I think it's actually something maybe I'll get with Steve, and we could create our own little subgroup. And
sure, but the razor clam issue, I put note that when we're actually defining our outcomes, that may be something we want to consider is money to take a look at that industry as part of this whole. So the answer is yes, but let's do it later.
Yep.
Yes, sir.
My question is sort of a related one to this, and actually goes back to what Senator Johnson was asking for additional research needs. But it seems like we're certainly seeing, and as you noted, ocean acidification is not going to go away. It's going to stay at our coast for a long, long time, hundreds of years, basically, and increasingly get worse. So it seems like there's a lot of other organisms that we may not be commercially currently utilizing or thinking about, but they're also changing, and there's going to be these changes in our habitats, these estuary habitats. So it seems like we need some additional estuary ecologists, estuarine ecologists, to forecast what habitat changes we're going to see, so we can begin to predict and develop some scenarios to say, okay, what's going to happen with these native species that we currently are harvesting, clams, etc. Species we're planting, such as oysters in later stages than just the juvenile stages, what's happening with the eelgrasses. We just need to be able to start predicting what could be happening so we can begin to get ready. We may not be able to get ready anything in some of these native habitats. Certainly the hatcheries can adapt at this point currently, but it seems we need to get on top. We know it's happening, so we can do some forecasting, but it would be great to have enough research to do a better job of the forecasting. And certainly at this point, ODFW is doing some great mapping things. We saw that Brett has done some mapping in Washington. We'd like to see that mapping occurring down here in Oregon as well. So there's some of this stuff already is ongoing, but I think we can certainly use additional ecology work just to know what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Like I said, we are trying to expand our lab, or I guess my advisor is trying to expand the research directions of our lab to include these ecosystem level approaches, but it's very difficult to get funding for these kind of projects. It's much easier to get funding for a very short-term project that you have deliverables that happen really quickly. And one thing I didn't say is that even the experimental work that I presented here that informed all these other projects where Chris London's lab was also very involved, that takes a lot of work. Some of the experiments that we've done require sometimes more than 10 people running and doing the work. So I agree, and I think there's plenty of people, researchers, very interested on answering all those questions, which are very difficult. Predicting is very difficult. But we just need support, even the students. I'm just speaking from my own experience. Yeah.
Thank you. Senator.
A personal question. What's the subject of your dissertation?
The subject of my dissertation is basically ocean acidification and oysters, everything. I've been involved in some of these projects. I've done work on the larval stage. I'm also doing work on the juvenile stage, and I'm also involved in the ecosystem level project.
Wonderful.
So basically a jack of all trades oyster.
Thank you for your presentation.
Dr. Romero.
I want to make three quick points, and the first one is just to raise to everybody's attention that we have a world-class training facility going on here in Oregon, and yet we are going to lose really talented people out of state. Matt Gray, that was just sitting back here, is about to go, so we're providing good expertise to other locations in the United States that need this help and expertise, but that's going to be in Maine. But we're just losing another one of Iria's colleagues down to San Diego. That's part of universities to train people up so that they can, you know, be successful elsewhere, but it'd be great to keep some more.
We'd like to
here.
Grow some of our own.
Give us some ideas for stickiness.
Yeah, how do we
sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Let's do it.
Second point I wanted to raise as well, a couple points. That my shellfish team is actively mapping shellfish and estuarine habitats throughout the state. We're charged with doing that. We've worked here in Yaquina Bay, completed Tillamook Bay and Neatarts Bay. We did Siletz Bay and Alsea Bay, and now we're moving forward over the next couple of years to complete Coos Bay. Coos Bay is a big bay, so we're generating that habitat level information both for the bivalves as well as the seagrasses, native and non-native, burrowing shrimp. A lot of that information is coming together. We do a comprehensive job, so it takes us about a year per bay, but we're working on the big bays first, so we should have that information.
Have you found that mapping exercise to be controversial? And let me contrast it. When there were fish inventories being done, the fishing industry was quite sensitive for competitive reasons about having that information sort of out on the avenue. Have you found the same degree of industry sensitivity?
Well, we've worked in cooperation with the commercial oyster growers, shellfish growers, and as far as I can recall, I think we've just had one person who has expressed concern about us stepping on and mapping the habitat there.
Okay.
So not really. The third point I wanted to make as well is that I'm a co-PI on an ocean acidification project to extend some of the great work that's happened with commercial oysters to the native bivalves, similar to what Claire described here as well. So we're very interested in what the impacts will be to our cockles, butter clams, gaper clams, softshell clams as well. We are not going to tackle that problem of razor clams that I raised up, so I wanted to make sure that that's still on the radar.
Help me understand a little bit the sensitivity about the razor clams, because I know Whiskey Creek isn't doing any razor clam larvae. So what's the deal with razor clams?
Razor clam larvae are notoriously difficult to raise through metamorphosis and to get through these early post-larval stages up to a point where they can survive on their own. They have been raised. British Columbia has raised them. We've raised them up in Washington and down at Oregon Institute of Marine Biology. But they're not on a commercial scale. Fortunately, the natural recruitment of razor clams has been sufficient to support a very active recreational fishery and commercial fishery, both here in Oregon and in the outer coast of Washington. So there hasn't really been a need to raise them in cultivation at this point.
Thank you.
So Steve raised the issue of losing good scientists to places around the world. I would just note that Bob Cowan, director, wasn't here today, or he would have presented what's going to happen with the Marine Studies Initiative. And the key to that, right, we're going to be bringing 500 undergraduates to do marine research and education out here at the Science Center, right? With the new building we've gotten support from the legislature for. The question for this group, when Bob does, and Bob will be at a future meeting.
We will bring him to our next meeting.
Right, so is to have this discussion about what will the future be like in terms of education in aquaculture and research in aquaculture that could bring people to this state and region and keep them here, right, to do a variety of both in the private sector and public sector.
Right.
Good. We will invite him to come and be on our agenda in the next session.
Right.
That leads me to a handout that you have in front of you that just came across my desk, and I may not pronounce this correctly, sir. Dr. Henschmaker? Is that close? has brought to my attention that he has a funded, granted program that started a couple of years ago around the economic impact of regulations on shellfish and trout aquaculture, and I would like to invite him to our next meeting also to do an update on what's happening with the research that he's doing on the impact of regulations on shellfish. So this just came to me, and we'll address it at our next meeting if you'd be willing to join us, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. We're now way behind. I thought we were 10, now we're 20. I need to do two things before we start our tour, and then some of you can wander, and I hope a lot of you will stay and take the tour with me, and I apologize for being late, but we've done an awful lot in a short time. I draw your attention to future task force meetings and topics. I would like to take your temperature. What we have tentatively put forward is a calendar looking at a third meeting, March, somewhere in between March 7th and 18th in Salem, and a fourth meeting in the week of April 18th to 29th, and that would be our tour of Whiskey Creek and Neatarts Bay, and then a fifth meeting in May, end of May, 1st of June at OIMB possibly, talking about water quality monitoring, wild shellfish stock. And then should we need one, a sixth meeting, which I'm assuming we will, to get our work done in July, location to be determined on the economic, socioeconomic costs and benefits of this incredibly rich industry. So my question to you is, how would you like to work through scheduling meetings? Would you like me to have staff reach out, do a doodle poll, figure out who's available when? Do you want to talk about them date by date? Now, is that the easiest way to everybody grab a calendar, which will take some time?
Doodle poll.
Doodle poll. Everybody know how to use a doodle poll? Okay. Dan, you know how to use a doodle poll?
I do.
Okay.
It's pretty simple if you've never used it before.
Okay.
It's, yeah.
Then I've been using doodle polls for 10 years, so I'm going to turn it over to Dan to get those out to you in the next week or so, and we will schedule these next sets of meetings accordingly. Does that meet everyone's satisfaction? Okay, and we just passed around a piece of paper that had the five areas of interest on it for you to sign where you have an interest in helping us move this initiative forward. Once I get that back, Senator Johnson, we'll sit down with staff and figure out how we're going to collect everybody and move these groups forward. How are we doing? Yes, sir.
Good question. Can I ask you about the end game? So with our schedule here, which I think is a great schedule, that should leave us about 2 months or so to write up our report and recommendations. How will we present that? Or what do you think that will look like? Will that be a printed report and then a presentation to the Oregon or the Coastal Caucus? Or
the Coastal Caucus may be an appropriate place to vet.
I would
this
certainly
initially.
Vet the first draft with the Coastal Caucus, and then I would hope that would lead directly into bill promulgation if the recommendation of this group is to move forward with some specific legislation. It's surprising how quickly the time goes, so we would need to kind of have our track shoes on. The concepts that get sent to Ledge Council generally need some refinement and wordsmithing before they come out. But if we're gearing up for 2017 legislation, I'd start with the Coastal Caucus.
In September.
And perhaps make it a bill at the request of the Coastal Caucus. And for those that are listening and are not familiar, the Coastal Caucus are those legislators that have the privilege of representing the coast, the full length of the coast. And we constitute just about 10% of the legislature and have had a very productive track record of support for both legislation as well as administrative changes. And I would certainly hope that whatever our work product is, the Coastal Caucus would be behind 100%.
And for those who don't know, and they fully supported the bill that brought this task force together, we are bicameral, bipartisan. There are eight of us, four House, four Senate, four R's, four D's, and the work that we do is all about what's happening on the coast. And I think that makes sense. Maybe Ledge Days, we'd set it up for the Coastal Caucus during the legislative days early in the fall, which will give us plenty of time to vet, draft a bill, and then get it prepared to drop for the 17th session, which we'll have to have the bill ready by.
I would just suggest as a courtesy to the committee that I undoubtedly staff will take a first pass at the, or a designated drafter will take a first pass at the consensus, run it by this group, then schedule the Coastal Caucus, then schedule a trip to Ledge Council to get bill language drafted.
So we do have work to do between now and September. Once again, thank you all for participating. We're about 25 minutes late starting our tour, so I would like to culminate this. We will
have 1 minute before we close off.
Yeah, and then we're going to reconvene, and we have to gavel out when we get back. So.
Okay. I just wanted to note that there was a lot of talk today about the Olympia oyster, the native oyster here in the West Coast, and there has been a guide put forth by a number of researchers conservation folks that was initiated out of California in terms of how to restore and conserve the Olympia oyster. Here in Oregon, myself and folks from the South Slough National Estuary Research Reserve and others certainly contributed to this in terms of data. So I have a few copies here. You're welcome to them. I can get more if people want them. I'm sorry I didn't have one for everybody here, but if you'd like to see what's being done and what's being proposed and what the issues are, you should know that Oregon was that we were the folks who raised ocean acidification as a concern for the Olympia oyster since it's hitting us face first in Neatarts Bay. So help yourself. We can get more of these if someone came up short.
Is that available online? Dan could send
I'm
it
sure
out to everyone?
I'm sure it's online.
Okay.
I'm sure it's online. And
so actually,
if you want a hard copy, but yeah.
I'd love a copy, but I would love to have Dan search for it, find it, and try to send it out to everyone. All right.
Thanks.
On that note, we are temporarily adjourned here. We're going to go on our tour, come back, and I just understand from Dan we don't officially have to gavel out. So we think we have the room until we're back from our tour so we can leave our things here. Is that correct? Okay. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? We'll commence our tour. All right. Anything else for the good of the order? We'll commence our tour.